Whenever feasible, one should always try to eat the root. Would you join me at the table?
Welcome to Eat the Rootcast, a podcast about Hannibal and the works of Thomas Harris. Notice I didn't say NBC because it is no longer NBC's Hannibal.
Oh, even though it's because it's already aired, it's no longer.
I'm not letting them take credit anymore.
Oh,
I'm done.
Well, fine.
Okay.
Because I think legally they still own.
Do they?
Yeah.
Do they want it? Mm. That's the question. They don't seem to want it, as far as I've noticed.
It's the redheaded stepchild.
Okay.
They
Saturday night to maybe run a football game instead. I don't know. We don't really need it. I'm Cooper, and tonight I have with me.
Hi, I'm Miko,
and this is Ophelia.
And tonight we're not talking about an episode because obviously we've talked about all the episodes.
Oh, there are no more.
And this is not the first Eat the Rootcast to come after the episode. So if it seems a little weird that we're talking as though this was the first time we haven't talked about an episode, it's because we're recording this one first and the other one later.
We're being timey-wimey. In real life, this is the first time we're talking.
This is.
Yes.
This is the first post-series season. Episode of Eat the Rootcast.
But we have a special guest for our first scheduled
so timey
to be
whiny,
released.
Bubbly wobbly.
So we
what we're doing tonight is we're talking about Red Dragon, the film, film
loosely using that term.
We wanted to have Manhunter be first, and then the Anthony Hopkins Lecter trilogy in the middle,
mm-hmm.
and then speaking of redheaded stepchilds, that movie at
that
the
we
end,
haven't watched yet.
Yes,
that we haven't watched yet. We will watch.
We
it.
Will.
There has been some discussion of just drinking through the entire thing. I want to spend as little time with Hannibal Rising as I can. I feel like I shouldn't prejudge it, but I know.
But you are.
I have. And
yeah.
And
it
the best part is I know I'm right about it. And then
I'm just hoping that it's so bad I'll love it. Because there are movies that are so bad, I think they're awesome.
What is it, Troll 2?
Oh,
so bad. You love that, it.
That was not
the first one that came to mind.
That's a whole other realm.
Yeah.
Troll 2 is just a step above The Room.
Oh, yes. But there's one.
I would say it's
so bad
that you love
it.
Step above The Room. I've seen both of these movies.
Okay. Well,
I don't know what it's a big step closer to. It's just above The Room because The Room is terrible.
Well, let's talk about Red Dragon.
Yes.
And we recommend, I mean, you don't have to, but we recommend going and watching the film before you listen to this episode, because unlike our show, the Eat the Rootcast proper, we are not going to go scene by scene, line by line, and take you through the film. So you can't really glean the film without having actually seen it.
Yeah.
And you'll just get more enjoyment from seeing it. So go watch the film.
Go.
We'll wait.
Go now.
We'll be right here.
We'll be here when you're done.
I'm just going to say, I like Red Dragon more than Manhunter.
Ooh, I do not.
I. What's interesting, because there's plus and minuses to both.
True.
I can't even say, I think, you know, on the scales, I'm about equal.
Okay.
Because there are some things I like. Some characters are better characterized in Red Dragon than they are in Manhunter. And they're not dealing...
Our main characters, in fact.
Yeah. But then there's like some of the over-the-top stuff or people who aren't acting at all in Red Dragon.
Yeah.
They're better.
There's a lot of people who are not acting.
Yeah, there is. There's a lot of non-acting.
And I'm like, what are you doing, guys?
Yeah.
I know you can do better than this.
Phantom Menace level non-acting.
Like they were directed to be dry.
Well, and that's, I mean, really, it's funny because when you think about this, if you're not in the film industry and you think about really how much influence does a director have on a project, if the actors are talented, and really you don't need to look any further than The Phantom Menace to see what happens when talented actors meet a really, you know, George Lucas is a terrible director.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
He's great story guy.
Oh, yeah.
Terrible at most everything else.
Yeah. He should never direct his own work.
So seeing Liam Neeson, Ewan McGregor, Natalie Portman, all fail spectacularly to do anything of value.
She got the brunt of it.
She did. She's, you know, tour de force actress, has done amazing work.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can't get that out of her, that is not her.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, that's what people see on the screen.
Right.
And if you're not in the industry, the first thing you're going to do is blame the actor.
Exactly.
And but the rest of us knew, it's like, no. Those people should have been like amazing us on the screen. But sometimes even the best of actors, if they're not getting what they need from a director, especially when they're acting to blue screen on dots on people's faces, it becomes really difficult.
That's and unfortunately, when the public is what's going to determine who gets billed in the next movie. And unfortunately for her, that ruined a lot of prospects because people don't want to put you in their movie after the public sees you in a negative light as a bad actress.
Yeah, even though she's like done amazing work.
It's almost as though you two don't want to talk about Red
Dragon. I'm sorry. are we digressing?
I mean, there's been a lot of conversation about things that are not Red Dragon.
They're related, honestly.
They're related.
Let's talk about the actors in the film we're talking about.
The pseudo equality that I seem to have with both of these things. I do. Like, I think there's so many plus and minuses, and each film falls short
in such a great way, but in different ways.
Exactly. It's really hard for me to say that any one of them is better than the other. And because Manhunter was my introduction to the whole thing, I think I have, it's not that it makes it my favorite movie, but I think I give it a little bit more leeway because, you know, that was like my first introduction to the whole storyline. You know, I actually got to see that before Silence came out.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
I didn't see it in a theater, but I watched it on TV and thought it was really interesting. And I actually hadn't made the connection when Silence came out because it had been so long.
That it was a follow-up.
But it wasn't until later on where someone was like, oh my God. And it was one of those movies that we just like to watch because we like Brian Cox. And it has a lot of good actors in it. It's just dated because
it was made in the 80s, which is an era of just being dated by existing.
Totally, yeah. But what I find interesting about Red Dragon is that they tried to do a period, a quote period piece that fails spectacularly, at least in my eyes as a historian and a designer.
let's start with what are the pros of this film, not necessarily versus Manhunter, because we should take each of these things as their own independent entity. I mean, it's a little harder with Red Dragon because it's specifically a let's do the thing that we did wrong the first time. Let's do it right this time.
Mm-hmm.
But we essentially had that with this past half season of Hannibal.
Yeah,
is we had another version. Let's get it right. That I feel like it gets right so much more than both of these films, but at the same time, it really jettisons about half the adaptation.
Yeah.
Which is weird because there has never been a full adaptation of Red Dragon. Nothing has decided to adapt this phenomenal book from start to finish with all of the stuff inside.
I wonder why people don't. Well, I guess it is a very meaty book. And Thomas Harris gives all of his characters a great amount of, for lack of a better term, screen time.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's really well developed. It isn't, hey, let's go get that guy that's going to find out how to get this print.
Right,
You know, forensics guy comes in and does it. Or it's somebody.
You learn about everybody.
You learn about everybody. Yeah. Every single character has a backstory. And it's kind of poetically written the way he talks about each person. And maybe that's overwhelming when people are trying to put that, when they're trying to cut down. But I
feel like that's a bad excuse.
Oh, yeah.
It's not good enough. Sorry.
Ophelia is cutting this film no slack.
Apparently.
No.
None.
I didn't say it was a good excuse.
Right.
But knowing how people in the industry sometimes look at stuff like this, and knowing you can't put every word on a page on a screen.
Right.
Don't get
unless
me
you're doing a miniseries.
Are you going to talk about another film instead?
I almost did. I'm not going to.
Let me ask this. Ophelia, name one thing that you liked about this film?
I knew you were going to do this. Because the second you said, let's look at the positive, I'm like, oh, boy.
I really, no. I mean,
there are positives. Hey, there are positives.
I can list many things that I like about this film. I'll start. Danny Elfman's score was really wonderful.
You said that when the movie first started. He's going to be the best part about this movie.
Well, he's also first on my list, just is why I'm starting with him. I really like Anthony Hopkins' performance in this. I mean, he's obviously older Lecter, not his fault.
Yes.
He's obviously put on a good deal of weight, probably not his fault. I don't want to fat shame the man, but he we talked about he's got a little bit of Kelsey Grammer as Latter-day Fraser Crane syndrome. You know, when he'd come out of the bedroom shirtless for whatever reason, he's all barrel chest and very little stomach. And it's just like, we know you're sucking it in.
Yeah.
It's okay.
We can tell.
And at one point, it did look like he was wearing a corset under his
he had Spanx
his
on.
blue hospital jumpsuit. I mean, it just looked like, but it's not his fault.
Yeah.
And really, this was a big response to the reaction to Hannibal, which is a very divisive movie.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people felt that he went way too big. I happen to adore his performance in Hannibal, but this is far, far closer to who he was in Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah. Okay. I found something.
Okay.
It's going to focus on teeth. So
feel free.
Some of the
no CGI teeth. There were no
positive.
Right. There were none.
Not one single CGI tooth.
Well, there's a scene where they zoom in. It looks like it's just like, I don't know how to describe the shot because I don't have the right words to use for it.
But I can help you.
It's a zoomed in old photograph, black and white. But there's a bit of weird shading on the teeth of the grandma. So there's a picture of grandma. That I don't know if it starts a scene or closes out a scene. I think it starts a scene where it's, you know, super zoomed in and you just see like the mouth and then it pans out and you see the whole picture. Sitting on like a dresser,
I think it was on the nightstand. I think that was after Dollar Eyed and Reba
got it on off camera. Yeah. Off, right.
Yeah.
No
pure mood sex music for you.
And no, we don't get to see, you know, any of the sex. It's just implied.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was a little bit chilling because you see the crooked, I don't want to say snaggletooth, but I feel like that's the only thing that
that's
I can use to describe
accurately
it.
Describe.
Right, the crooked
teeth.
We're
not grandma shaming, it's okay.
In fairness, grandma sounds like a monster.
Feels like
you
something
shame
that you
her
would,
all you want.
You would taunt a poor child with bad teeth. So I don't want to say the words, but I already did. Anyway, the messed up teeth, and they're a slightly different color. Mm-hmm. Which I'm sure can't actually happen when you develop black and white film.
No, that would have been digitally post-processed.
It looked a bit greenish brown and the, like zoomed in on the teeth. And I felt like that told so much.
Mm-hmm.
Like that you could tell because they'd already gone over the teeth. They've already gone over his bite. They've already shown the dentures. And at least I think they had at this point.
Yes, I think they did early.
And then they just show the picture of the grandma. Wearing the teeth, and you can just glean so much information off of seeing that was lacking in Hannibal, the television series.
Yeah.
We didn't get any of the backstory. I think if just something like this had been slipped in, it could have told at least a fraction of the story. We could have went like, oh, okay, that's fucked up. You know, like we don't really have to know all the details to know that there's something messed up between Dollar Hyde and Grandma.
Right.
Yeah. And they did do that well here because they didn't dwell on it. They didn't.
No.
We didn't have to do a whole entire flashback
that
really explained it, you know, everything. It was little things.
And Ellen Burstyn.
Yes,
the voice of Grandma, which was wonderful.
Yeah.
Though that scene was a little bit of exposition-y. It was just like, oh, this is what we call dialogue with air quotes.
Yeah.
It was not actual dialogue.
But that's all, you know, they were able to do it without actually like having to film the scene.
Right.
It was just like the memory of it, of
and
the voices.
They showed the children's drawing.
Yeah.
His drawings.
So they were able to kind of give you the backstory without giving you all of the information. And it was just enough to know so that at the end you get that he was really messed up by his grandma. Yeah. He has an issue with this. And we didn't get that at all in Hannibal. There wasn't any kind of indication.
Or in Manhunter.
Yeah, yeah.
There's really we have no idea of what Dollar Eye's backstory was.
We don't know why he is the way he is.
And everyone seems to be fine with not knowing, you know, the details. But it was nice as a reader and wanting to see more of what's in the book. It was a nice way of handling that, of being able to apply it. They apply it a little too much in the end, and I kind of was not too happy about that.
Yeah.
But sometimes it's nice to know what's going on in the mind of the killer.
And I do kind of have a gripe about, I don't think that information would be in the book.
I don't either.
Mm-hmm. I don't think.
And we're specifically talking about Will Graham's very, very, very poor parenting and ill-advised gambit here at the end, where Dollar-Eyed has his son with a big old shard of mirror.
I think he might have held on to maybe his own drawings, perhaps, or something like that. But I don't think they would put it in the murder book.
Not the murder book.
Dollar-Eyed's Big Book of Murder.
Big Book of Murder.
Not in the murder book.
I was right there with you on that. When he opened it up and there was all
of... Like it might be in
a
filing cabinet somewhere.
The diary stuff. Him. I was like, I could see that being in a separate book.
Yeah. Because this book is the Book of the Red Dragon.
Right, exactly. And there should be nothing about his weaknesses.
No, because that's what torments him. So he would want to forget that. Yeah.
He would want to assume the Red Dragon on top of all of that.
And it's worth mentioning that this is in no way the book.
Yeah. Right.
This
right.
climax
No one wants to do the book
a ridiculous,
climax, really.
The book climax, too, we'll probably have talked about this next week, last week, and the Manhunter podcast. But the book climax ends with Will Graham gets stabbed in the face, surprised by Dollar-Eyed, stabbed in the face, who then goes into the house and Molly winds up killing him, which is amazing.
Oh, it is.
Yeah,
it's amazing considering the time that this book was written to.
Yeah,
to empower Molly.
Well, right off the bat, Thomas Harris demonstrates that he really likes strong female characters. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's debatable whether he continues to like strong female characters considering the arc of Clarice Starling. But it's really impressive at the beginning.
I guess if you look at it through the lens of the time. Mm-hmm. You know, and what other people were doing and the environment that you're in. The fact that he has anything that is that creates strong, independent women who aren't leaning on men for support,
self-rescuing princesses.
Exactly. And aren't characterized as being hypersexualized or, you know, the way the women are even described in a lot of this, from Molly to Clarice, very, very like strong, feminine, yet not, you know, sexy. Or they can be athletic and strong and independent. Molly is a great character. They really get into Will and Molly's relationship a lot more, which I understand is too much to go into in a film.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. But it was nice that you got to see what she was struggling with. And the choices that she had to make and how Will has to deal with that while he's trying to find a killer. Mm-hmm. His marriage is falling apart. Yeah. But in that, writing this at that time period, you didn't see a whole lot. It was always, you know, pretty girly, sidekicky kind of women who, even when they were independent and strong, usually came across as girly.
Occasionally, the Molly of the book does come in that whole needy category that we were praising the show for avoiding. And this movie does pretty well avoiding that aspect of Molly. You know, she's a little concerned, but she's also supportive. And Mary Louise Parker plays Molly in the film and does a fine job, not a great job. And she does have her standard breakdown at the end of the film after killing Dollar-Eyed, though with a very nice headshot.
Yes.
So she and Will must have been out on that cattle ranch range for hours upon hours.
Or she's
upon
a fast
hours.
Learning.
Well, maybe that.
Natural.
I mean, would it have killed them to have her hook Dollar-Eyed with a fishing pole? Would it have killed them to do that? That is one of the best moments, and that is the most memorable thing for me from the book Red Dragon, from the first time I read it, was Molly hooking Dollar-Eyed's face with a fishing pole.
But the fishing pole has much more meaning, too.
Yeah.
Because we've gone through that storyline with a lot of her memories of her deceased husband coming back when they go back to the in-laws. And that's when Will feels like he's losing them. Mm. And Willie or Wally or Josh.
Or Josh in this
film.
Yeah,
Josh in this film. You know, Willie is reacquainted with the memories of his father. Yeah. And his father and his grandfather, the father-in-law, gives him the fishing pole that was his father's. And this is really hard for Will. They fish together. Willie comes back with this fishing pole and does not want to use the one that Will has given him, mm-hmm. even though it's better. He'd rather use the one that doesn't work because it belongs to his father. The whole thing about baseball, that is also a callback to little Willie's dead father. So the fishing pole thing in the book is so much more strong and meaningful because they've already had all this stuff happening. You've seen you've read the interaction between Will and Willie about the fishing pole and how he feels like they're slipping through his fingers. He's changed because of what's going on. And, Molly doesn't quite feel safe. She almost stays in Oregon. She has a job,
yeah.
but then decides to come back. So using that fishing pole really means something. It is.
It's good character development.
Exactly. But if you don't go into that in the movie,
it's still a cool moment.
You know, so you just
whether
want it
there's
for the
character
cool
development
factor.
Or not, it's
like,
an
she should
awesome
just pick
moment.
Up a random fishing pole
I mean,
and hook him
yeah.
in the
seriously,
face.
This climax, and Dollar-Eyed knows where they are
mm-hmm.
because yeah. he's followed them upstairs.
Yeah.
Molly's coming up the stairs, and Will doesn't think to say, hey, Molly, he's at the top of the stairs. He knows where they are. Yeah. They're not hiding from him.
Yeah.
Why is this a suspenseful? Why is Dollar-Eyed allowed to get behind Molly?
Yeah.
What the fuck is that?
There's a lot of what the fuck is that
there
in this
is.
Movie, unfortunately.
It is bad directing. It's not being aware of your space, and it's really not being aware of the story you're telling.
No.
Yeah.
And I think that is the biggest issue this film has, is Brett Ratner is a mimic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he did a very good job replicating the look of Silence of the Lambs.
Mm-hmm.
This
oh,
movie
yeah.
looks like Silence of the Lambs, with the exception of it being shot in 2:3:5:1 aspect ratio when silence is 1:8:5. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, it looks like it. The Baltimore State Hospital was no longer allowed to be used for filming whatever that building was.
Oh.
Either that or it was gone. So that shot...
Yeah.
is from Silence of the
Lambs.
Oh,
that's interesting. What building did they use?
I don't know. But it's no longer available.
Was it an LA location or was that like a
If I know Demi, it was probably a East Coast location.
Oh, an East Coast location. Yeah. Only cuz I know I was wondering if it's a there was a hospital that everybody used to use in LA and then it was bought out by a Christian organization. You uh-huh. couldn't shoot there anymore. So I was wondering, because I can't remember what it looked like in Silence. But if it was an East Coast location, then it probably wasn't that.
But it really feels like, you know, he's very close
mm-hmm.
and he thinks he's nailed it.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that's what this film feels like to me, is someone who thinks I have made a film that is as least the equal to Silence of the
yeah.
Lambs.
Oh, you can totally tell that.
And it just, and he's got a lot of support on that front.
There's You'd great actors in this movie.
Edward Norton would be supporting, but you know, to the point where Brett Ratner says Hannibal is going to rattle you in this interaction.
Mm-hmm.
And Edward Norton says, no, you know what? Will Graham's a seasoned pro. He wouldn't be rattled by Hannibal Lecter. You know, maybe we'll just give me some pit stains, and then it'll look like I was sweaty.
Wait, is that what happened?
That is exactly what happened.
Because I remember the pit stains.
Yeah.
yeah.
So that is... So,
I didn't know that was the interchange. I think the director should have put his foot down at that point. Like,
well,
no.
You know what? A director with experience You've and a director stabbed. Who wasn't afraid of his actors probably mm-hmm. would.
Oh.
And it probably would have given us a better performance.
Well, the bottom line is Will Graham is not interesting in this film at
no.
all.
Nope.
He is very damaged and interesting. I mean, our perception of Will Graham is very different now.
Yeah.
Before this mm-hmm. series, William Peterson was the interesting Will Graham. William Peterson was the weird Will
no,
Graham.
The book
William Peterson
Will Graham
was the poor.
Interesting.
Well, yes, of the films.
We're talking about the
Will Graham
the
in my head.
The Will Graham in the book, it's not. He's nowhere near as damaged as the Will Graham we have come to love.
Yes.
But he's damaged.
Yes.
The Will Graham in the film, sort of crazy. This Will Graham, bland, walked out of a CSI type procedural show, mm-hmm. and not even as interesting. You know, William Peterson's character on CSI, far more interesting than this Will Graham.
Yeah, it kept sort of bothering me about his performance. Mm-hmm. And I remember this from when we just watched like the first 15 minutes that one day, where I was just like, what was that? It was like, someone got like their 12-year-old nephew to go and be, you know, Will Graham for a little while. It was so just bland and mm-hmm. not very multifaceted. And then watching the whole thing, it just continued through the whole film. Yeah. And I was sitting there looking at this character going, I'm not convinced that you are this person who has this incredible gift.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, he doesn't even seem to have a gift here.
No.
He's basic detective. It's like, oh, hey, talcum powder, right? Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So, what is your special skill? Yeah. Why can't Jack Crawford walk in and do that?
Right.
Right.
Right. Or exactly. anyone else. And especially since it's part of, you know, the character's, you know, backstory and how he's written in the book is that because he can go into the mind of the killer, this has been a very dangerous, on the border of insanity mm-hmm. situation for him.
Yeah.
It's the Will Graham we are presented with at the very beginning of this book.
Well, and when Hannibal Lecter says, the reason you caught me is because we are very much alike.
Yes.
That's true.
Yes.
Not for this Will Graham,
no.
I mean, this Will, really, nothing in this film demonstrates a Will Graham who's anything like Hannibal Lecter, especially Anthony Hopkins' Hannibal Lecter.
Oh, yeah.
And it's frustrating because, I mean, it feels very clear to me that Edward Norton had no interest in the source material. I'm sure he never read it mm-hmm. because that's a far more interesting character to play. If he'd read it, he probably would want to play that character.
Yeah.
It's not Ted Talley's fault that he did not go into Will Graham's backstory as much. Ted Talley, the screenwriter of Silence of the Lambs and Red Dragon. Mm. It's like he read the script and performed exactly what was in the script.
Yeah, with nothing,
no nuance
to
nothing.
Exactly, and it is, and it remains that there are moments where I was like hoping, like when he goes back and he's trying to like recreate, you know, the scene, and there was just I was like, what are you doing?
Yeah,
are you actually thinking about? I can't.
He didn't seem rattled at all.
No, there was so much there that just was. It was so uninteresting to watch. I didn't feel like he was really investigating.
Disaffected.
Yeah.
That's the
very
word.
Very much so.
Very much so.
Disaffected by everything he saw.
Yeah.
He was disaffected by Hannibal, mm-hmm. disaffected by this power he supposedly has. Mm. And yeah. Yeah.
You know, and especially after the history that they have. I mean, he did nearly get gutted by Hannibal.
I know.
You would think that their interactions would have some emotional
weight?
They
energy.
Made a very big point to show us the scar.
Oh, they totally did. It was like, it's a scar. You
look
get
at
it?
It?
Look at it.
So let's talk about that. Okay. I mean, obviously, the only reason this movie was made is because they had a very successful movie and sequel, mm-hmm. Silence of the Lambs and Hannibal. And they had this outlier film that no one even really believed was a Hannibal Lecter film.
You're right.
And if they watched it, they'd be like, why are they spelling Lecter with a CK? Where's Anthony Hopkins?
Right. Where's the glass cell?
So
and
they say, okay, well, let's go back to the beginning. Let's redo this with our new cast.
It packages together very nicely.
It does. It's corporate synergy.
Yes.
And in order to do this, in order to make this what the people want, we have to expand Hannibal's part. And in some ways, they did well with expanding Hannibal's part. Mm. In some ways, you know, it's like theatrically opening up a story. When you talk about a play being filmed and you open it up, it's like if a play takes place in one room, well, we're not going to just have it in one room. We're going to go across the street to a bar. It's like right. Glengarry Glen Ross is a great example of opening up a play successfully. Their opening up of this story puts Hannibal in a weird sort of hamster cage room that couldn't possibly exist for any other prisoner at that asylum, which means it was built entirely for Hannibal Lecter, mm-hmm. which means what the fuck?
Yeah.
Why would Chilton do that?
Yeah. And the whole like opening shot when he goes in there.
Oh, when we're supposed to think that Hannibal is not, you know, is going to get him.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And I was like, Did this really look like a dungeon like this in the other movie? Like there was just something so theatrical about the stone.
Yeah.
And it's like, no. You have to paint it so it looks just stonier. Well, I don't know.
Hannibal's cell looked like that.
Yeah.
I mean, it is identical to Hannibal's cell from Silence of the Lambs. It was the basement of this old building that was converted into a really high security cell.
It just seemed more, I don't know, it seemed more convincing to me in Silence.
Well,
than
everything
it did here.
Seemed more convincing. Yeah.
It may have been the way it was shot. It may be that because you're dealing, you know, with the way things are shot now, where it's even film looks like HD. So, whereas Silence came out at a time where things have film quality is still important to people. You know, it's not all perfectly clear. It's lit in a very different way mm-hmm. where it just may have looked more natural and more like, oh, I see. They took some weird basement area of this really, really old mental institution and they built this.
Silence of the Lambs, I feel like, was shot a far more, it almost felt documentary. It looked like a 16mm film.
Yeah.
It looked low budget and that actually worked really well for the film.
Yeah. Whereas I think
This is polished.
It doesn't work for this, and that sort of hyper realism of going, you know, doing that long tracking shot down, you know, there's a lot of cheap jump scare in this movie.
Oh yes, that's one of my points.
Yeah,
too.
There was one in the beginning.
What was the one that
remember.
Freaked you out? Something happened that really flipped you out.
Oh, it was the dolls.
The dolls?
No, I don't know if that was it.
There was
when
one
they
that
zoomed in on the doll's eyes.
Yeah, they zoomed in on the doll's eyes.
I don't know if that was it.
Because that's the one I wrote was jump scare. Will is preparing himself
when he goes into the room
to go. And
I
wrote down prepares himself with quotes because all he does is pinch his fingers.
Well, yes, that is how you show stress.
Yeah,
tension.
He's preparing to get into the mind of the killer by looking like he has a migraine.
I mean, yeah, the extent of Edward Norton's acting in this film is rubbing his forehead,
mm-hmm.
pinching his nose, closing his eyes.
Yes.
That's it.
That was it right there.
That's
so
the
then you get
performance.
Into that and they add in overly dramatic strings.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then, you know, then all of a sudden it's like they're... I'm trying to read my writing here.
Well, the doll's eyes was how he realized that's what Dollar-Eyed was doing.
He goes back to the hotel room and he's looking at all the photos because mm-hmm. They're all spread out around him. But how he realizes it's the doll, it's a jump scare.
Yeah.
It's a close-up shot of the doll.
Mm-hmm.
And it does that in a, you know, kind of moment. And I was like,
I wrote cheap jump scares too, and lots of rubbing face and eyes. I really, really detested the lurid elements of this.
Mm-hmm.
During the Leeds murders, we had definitely sexualized murders
mm-hmm.
because we had flashes of breasts. We had in these things that, you know, in an R-rated film, I have no problem flashing nudity because it's titillating. Mm-hmm. None at all. There didn't need to be nudity in that scene. All it did was make you like, oh, hey, I'm really uncomfortable because that, you know, that I know what happened after that.
Right.
And
right.
So it's just upsetting.
Yeah.
And I know Brett Ratner was not intending for it to be a, hey, I'm going to make you feel weird about this.
Right.
He was thinking, hey, we got some nudity. Let's throw some nudity in there. Let's do that.
This seems like a good place to.
Yeah. Why not just throw it in the murder flashback? Yeah. Why not? Why not just do that?
Cheap scares. Cheap nudity.
Cheap nudity.
Cheap. And also, I mean, the biggest thing I noticed in, because the scenes in Hannibal's cell are shot very similarly to Silence of the Lambs, but Ratner is afraid to have them looking directly into the lens, which was one of the real hallmarks of Silence of the Lambs.
Oh, yeah.
Was this where Lecter and Clarice are looking at each other and we are each of them in the scene. And it's really unsettling. And it's something he gets really close to in these scenes between Will and Hannibal, but never actually goes to it. They're always looking slightly away.
There was one part where Hannibal's looking at the mirror and you can see Will.
Oh yes. He's looking in the distorted mirror. I made a note of that. That was one of the best shots in the film. One of the only really good shots.
I was debating between that as my best part or the grandma teeth, but I like the grandma teeth because it tells a story.
There can be more than one. I have several. Harvey Keitel.
Oh, I love Harvey Keitel.
Harvey Keitel's really good as Crawford.
Yes.
I mean, he's serviceable. I wish Scott Glenn had come back. We have this series.
Right.
And it seems like each movie just replaces
various characters. Anthony Hopkins. And doesn't make any apology for it.
No, it's fine. Yeah. You got Anthony Hopkins. You've got Frankie Faison. It's a Hannibal movie. Frankie Faison is Barney.
Yeah.
And he is actually the only actor to appear in all four.
Oh, really? I didn't realize
Well, see, there's five now. But if we exclude Hannibal Rising, Frankie Faison is in Manhunter. He doesn't play Barney, but he's in Manhunter, which is kind of cool.
Oh, that is cool. There was someone else I was surprised that was also in Manhunter. And I can't remember
the guy who was on Frasier was in Manhunter. He's also the bug guy in Silence of the Lambs, but I can't think.
Yeah, I was trying to remember. There was somebody that I saw that had credits in both movies, and I was like, wow, I didn't realize that they played like a completely different character, but came back and wound up doing like a character in like Silence or something like that. And it was interesting to see that crossover. I like that. Our Dr. Chilton comes back.
Oh, Anthony Held is great as Chilton.
Yeah. I mean, and I love him because he plays Smarmy so well.
He does. And he's a very different Chilton than Raul Esparza's Chilton. And they're both really good in their own ways. And he looks almost identical to the way he looked in Silence of the Lambs, which is great. You know, it's nice to see. So, but again, I can't fault Anthony Hopkins for aging.
And then that's the thing. The amount of time that has passed, there's nothing you can do.
Well, I love that. You know, we talked about this. In the opening sequence, it takes place in 1980.
Yeah.
Silence of the Lambs was 1991. This movie was 2002. So Anthony Hopkins is 11/12 years older, playing 11 years younger. And
it's a stretch.
You know, you can't just throw a ponytail on a guy and have him play that.
Exactly. And that was the thing. When we did that opening scene, I was like, really?
With the comically bad flautist. You know, that flautist does not get to continue play in this orchestra because he's ridiculous. It's not only Hannibal hearing this. It's everybody in the audience after that performance saying, hey, what's the deal with...
And I'm pretty sure you can't keep a job like that.
Yeah. No.
No.
Yeah.
Because there are thousands of flautists who would take their place.
Yeah. And that's what was really disappointing about that is not just that this guy would be fired if he was that bad, but it's the whole idea of Hannibal's hearing is so good. Like he didn't need to be bad. All of his senses are so heightened. He's this otherworldly, ability. For taste and smell, and so the fact that he could pick out the subtleties of this, of the flute playing not being up to par, is so much more interesting than everybody noticing that the flute player is bad.
Well, and apparently everybody doesn't notice except for the head of the organization there. But we needed to notice, the audience, and this scene, this opening sequence, is really indicative of everything that is to follow in the film because it is not subtle in any way.
No.
Every opportunity it has to be subtle, it's not subtle. Mm-hmm. So the flautist isn't subtle. The worst offense in this opening is Hannibal Lecter having written sweetbreads in his medical textbook.
Yes.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Why didn't he just find recipe cards that say human torso also works as?
Right.
I mean, it's like Movie for Dummies. I mean, it's seriously, it insults my intelligence.
Mm-hmm. I saw that and I was like, oh, really? We had to do that?
And again, you know, I thought the way Anthony Hopkins performed the scene was great.
Mm-hmm.
The realization that Will knows was great.
Yeah.
The telling Will what he's doing and to relax. He doesn't want to hurt him, though his movements, and obviously it's like that's, well, clearly this is going to hurt him, and maybe not what you wanted to do, but what the director asked you to do is going to hurt him. But then, okay, he gets stabbed with a quiver of arrows.
Yes.
Oh, that was so bad.
Shot multiple times.
Yes. All that happened, and I was just like, what?
Did we just do that? He kicked the arrows into Hannibal.
Yeah. It was... like telegraphed, like, hey, I wonder if those arrows are going to come into play.
Yeah, they totally did telegraph.
I want to say physics is against him there.
Well, no, he didn't. He grabbed them.
He grabbed them. Stabbed them.
Okay.
But he knocked him over, though.
Yeah. Well, and they did do that little thing where he like looked at
where
them.
Where he played with the fletchings.
Ooh, fletchings.
You like that?
Yeah.
It's got that, you know, we are talking about Hannibal Lecter stuff. We got to use good words.
We have to use good words.
Good proper extra words.
Wow. Not many people know archery terminology.
I thought it was silly.
It was very silly.
Yeah.
I've got a few
for
interesting
a very serious moment.
Few
moment.
Interesting factoids. Dante Spinotti, the cinematographer. Mm-hmm. Cinematographer for Manhunter.
How'd they do that?
Shot Red Dragon.
Really?
And this is my favorite thing that I didn't realize at the time, but was reading through IMDb. So Dennis Farina played Jack Crawford in Manhunter.
Mm-hmm.
Dennis Farina,
great actor.
Chicago cop turned actor.
Yeah.
Really cool. And then Harvey Keitel plays Jack Crawford in this one. Now, if you remember the film Get Shorty.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Dennis Farina has a major part in it. And then Harvey Keitel plays Dennis Farina in the movie, within the movie of Get Shorty. And has the best line, perhaps in cinema history. Fuck you, fuck balls.
Oh, my God, that made me cough. I laughed so hard.
So, I mean, that's obviously not consequential whatsoever, but it's a fun little diversion. We went from this ridiculously theatrical scene, this over-the-top, not subtle at all, to a great credit sequence that I assume was directed by one of the great credit sequence people. Mm-hmm. You know, it owed a lot to Seven, I think, with the use of the journal. And, but it was really good at telling the story from the moment we left it to the moment we come back without overly telling it. And if only the rest of the movie had been as subtle as the credit sequence,
exactly,
it could have been a really great. And we have, again, Danny Elfman's score.
Great score. Yeah. And it was like the Tattler headlines were great because it also gave us a great introduction to Freddie Lowndes because we get to see the tabloid headlines and all of that and how time has passed, but all done in that hyperbole, crazy, you know, in your face, you know, the predecessor to clickbait.
Hannibal Lecter captured. You won't believe why.
Exactly. Check out Inside. Exactly. You know, the leading, you know, those leading titles and those leading headlines and or having to have everything rhyme or be all in or have some alliteration that old you know what the Post used to do in New York all the time that everyone like love to hate.
Let's talk about some more of the Leeds house here.
Hmm.
They're setting Will Graham up to be the smartest man in the room. Really, that's what this movie is trying to do. It's showing us that he's a badass cop who can do anything. Really, that's what this movie's version of Will Graham is. And so nobody noticed that there was a dog house and a dog bed within visual distance of each other.
Yeah.
Because we see both of them in one shot.
Yeah.
Will Graham is the first person to ask, where's the dog?
Yeah.
Really?
Really?
Nobody thought about that? That there's a big dog bed?
Yeah.
Probably a big dog?
Mm-hmm.
Where's the dog? Everybody would think that.
Exactly.
This is not a new thing.
Yeah. It would be something if they...
And there was a dog in a photo on the fridge, just in case we didn't even get it.
Yeah, that does... That's.
There was a lot of spoon feeding in this.
Yeah.
Lots of it.
Well, there... And I think I said this when we got... like to the end, it was a lot of, hey, check this out, you get it.
It was as though Brad Ratner was sitting next to us watching the movie and just nudging us with his
elbow.
Did you see what I did there? Nodding his head like, watch this part. Do you see? Yeah, exactly.
The do you see is incredibly underwhelming.
Oh, it is. Mm-hmm. It is.
And
it was just sad.
Ray Fiennes.
I know. Exactly. That's why I cannot. I just simply cannot believe it was the actor's fault here.
Well,
no, I think it was a lot of the directing.
Yeah,
I can't.
I mean, it.
I mean, it's he who must not be named.
There's also the thing that, and today we learned from J.K. Rowling that's supposed to be pronounced Voldemort.
Oh, French.
Well, she said she thinks she's the only person who has ever pronounced it that way, but that's how it's supposed to be pronounced.
Yeah, you don't pronounce it.
She didn't bother to tell any of the filmmakers that, but, you know.
Like Merlot.
Let's get a nice Chianti. You know, I was talking about that with a friend, and that we'll talk about that more on Silence of the Lambs. But that is Anthony Hopkins making fun of Jodie Foster's accent. Every time you hear the wacky accents in Hannibal Lecter speak, he's making fun
of her.
And in Silence of the Lambs, she was so upset that he was making fun of her performance.
Really?
Yeah, but he was making fun of Clarice Starling.
Yeah.
And the fact that she was getting upset worked so well because she was trying to hide her accent.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But Jodie said she had thought that he was actually making fun of her.
That's hilarious. Yeah. It all works.
Let's talk about Philip Seymour Hoffman, because really, come on, you both could have mentioned Philip Seymour Hoffman as one of the great things about this film. You know,
we don't have to scratch
the surface far to find great things. I'm trying to go in
some kind of order here. We're willy nilly all over the place, which makes it thoroughly willy nilly here. So that's why it's like there are things I will mention when we start getting piggly willy.
It's the funniest thing I've ever heard of in my entire life. I had to say it.
Every time I go in, I drive past one of those grocery stores or go in one, I have to giggle because I'm like, I never saw one
until I was in my 20s and I went down south.
We used to have one really close to here.
I laughed so hard for so long. I'm like, are you kidding me? That's a store.
Yeah.
Somebody named a store.
Piggly Wiggly.
And I went into one and I just couldn't stop.
So yes, really what Ophelia laughing. Is saying is if you have Piggly Wiggly merchandise... or maybe a Piggly Wiggly logo, you should send it to her. And really, you know what? Piggly Wiggly goes really well with our Mason Verger.
It does. Oh, it goes very well with Mason Verger.
Oh, my God. Thank you to our fan who sent me a picture of the Funko Pop Mason Verger. It was amazing,
awesome.
Surrounded by little pigs. Love it so much.
It was adorable.
I want it. So whoever sent the picture... Find out where it came from and tell me how to get one.
I love that it had the Fimo dough.
That stuff.
Yeah, it looked like it was built up with, not phyllo dough. It was built up with
Mason tasty.
It's Fimo, right?
Fimo.
I said Fimo.
No, you said Fimo, and then
I think he said Fimo,
and he said phyllo.
It's clay.
I've worked with Fimo before. Yeah, you put it in the oven.
Yeah.
Like phyllo, but. Not as
Fimo. But not good to eat.
No. You would not eat it.
No, you wouldn't eat
no.
it.
No.
Did you notice it was Jack's idea for Will to go visit Lecter? It wasn't Will's?
I didn't notice that.
Because this version of Will Graham has to be the reluctant savior.
Ah.
So Jack is saying, hey, you should go do this thing. And Will's like, what are you saying, Jack? What are you saying? You're saying I should go revisit Hannibal Lecter?
That's interesting. I didn't even put that together.
The scene between Lecter and Will is almost word for word from the book, but only one of the actors is actually performing at the time.
the other one's phoning it in.
We have the wonderful line about Chilton. Mm-hmm. That he fumbles at your head like a freshman pulling at a panty.
I wrote that down too. That was great. And because this is set in a more dated time period,
we have no idea when this takes place.
Yeah,
because the timeline is really fucked up.
Oh here. Yeah, and we talked about this that it's somewhere 80s.
All we know is it has to be late 80s.
Yeah,
that's it.
And They kind of tried. They brought in some period cars.
They brought in some period VHS tapes, including Mrs. Doubtfire.
Which came out after
Silence of the Lambs, which is, you know, that's wonderful.
It was a very interesting VHS collection.
They either were using mini DV or high 8 tapes. I don't know. Mini VHS.
The fact that at this stage of the game, they had decided to use video.
And families were still sending their home movies out, even though they didn't need them converted anymore, sending them out to one company in the middle of the United States to turn them into those laughable VHS collections with the star wipes and everything.
Yeah.
What are we supposed to buy here?
Just have it be freaking film.
Yeah.
Why, if you've already...
It's a period piece.
It's a period piece. If you've established that the first thing... You put a time stamp on it. You put a title card on it says...
They only gave us 80s, one date. 1980. And that was for the opening scene.
So, you know it's somewhere between 1980 and 1989. Or 90. Or whenever, or, you know. Or if we want to say... Actually, they lead into that it butts right up to Silence.
Yeah.
So we can say it's late 80s. My recollection of the late 80s is not that you could do that with videotape. Not everybody was doing that.
No, you had full-size VHS tapes, and that was, let's say, at the earliest 88, 89.
Yeah.
You know, really, what people were still... People were still using film, or if you don't want to make it film, make it them sending their pictures out to be developed. Do something other than, because why would they do this?
Yeah.
Why they have the facility to play them back at home?
Right. It was a little forced, and then we had clueless, and then we had to sit through the lovely family video.
That video with horny dad.
Yeah. Yes. And that was kind of creepy to me that they made them like, again, we're probably colored by how, you know, we've seen with Hannibal that they did the family so well.
Yeah.
And they didn't give us too much of the families. They gave us just enough. But it was like the really hot wife.
Yeah.
And even like the husband was like kind of youngish and fit. And there were like, hey, I get it. Sometimes you want to be all over your husband. Not saying that that's not what, you know, married couples with kids do.
But home videos, do you really do that?
No.
When
you're there with your kids and you're doing like a wink, wink, nudge, nudge, Santa Moore thing to the camera. And
like,
grabbing your wife.
Why don't you bring that to bed later?
It was a little creepy and uncomfortable. And I didn't want them to be characterized that way.
No. Mm-hmm.
Especially when the whole idea of him like wanting to change these families is not that they seemed like there was something like sinful
or lewd
about them. I got the impression that their lives looked perfect.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that they seemed like very ordinary, regular, average.
Nothing would stand out.
Right, right.
And
other than
stuff,
they're happy and they're well off.
Yeah. That stuff felt like perhaps a filmmaker who wasn't quite certain what normal and average
looks like.
I mean, really, that very well could be it. This felt, there are a lot of things in this movie that feel like a Brett Ratner movie, like that turn of the 90s type movie. Mm-hmm. And this was made in the 2000s. I really bristled when Will Graham called his son a faggot.
Yeah.
Like I really had a problem with that. You know, I obviously have a problem with that term in general, right, yeah. But yeah. Tonally, I have a problem with that whole fucking scene.
Well, the whole scene was weird. It's so
odd, yeah. And out of nowhere. And again, is Dollarhide writing that in the big book?
Yeah.
No.
Is he right?
Would he even
He took artistic license.
Yeah. Oh, I think
he embellished.
Embellished.
This is the way like, a psychotic grandmother would talk to.
That's the way. Yeah.
Grandchild that they're abusing, mm-hmm. and then the fact that they didn't really fully commit to the time period.
No.
What the costumes kept bothering me because it was like some modern person's idea of what 80s looked like.
Well, and
like,
it's taking the entire decade.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, it's 80s. You know, it's like Wedding Singer 80s.
Yeah. But but even worse than that, at least Wedding Singer 80s looks 80s.
That's true. You know, they already made this movie and it looked 80s in Manhunter.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's sort of what made me laugh about it, is that if you wanted... The movie that looks 80s is Manhunter.
Mm-hmm.
But Manhunter looks 80s in that scary part of 80s of the hair and the slubbed jackets and things are cropped or the you know, all the stuff like all the TV shows that you remember at that time period that and movies and Miami Vice and all the sitcoms. It's like and all the movies. It's like I keep looking at, you know, that the 80s Will Graham and it looks like, you know, Miami Vice or Buckaroo Banzai or, you know, it's so stylized in the 80s style because it's seen through the eyeglass of that time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's going to have hair that looks like that. He's going to have a jacket because, man, in the 80s, he looked freaking rad. But now...
That's true.
He looks pretty dorky. Yeah. Whereas it's almost like somebody was offended by 80s aesthetic.
Yeah.
And didn't want to go there. Like, didn't want to fully commit to what the late 80s looks like.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't go with, hey, I'm going to make it stereotypical 80s and girls are going to have leg warmers and we're going to have neon colors and big earrings and shoulder pads. You didn't even see that. Yeah. It's like, I don't know. Like, Molly was wearing the torn jeans of the 90s. Mm-hmm. She looked grunge.
Yeah.
You know, was she supposed to look
with
hippie?
A little bit of hippie. She had grunge with hippie. Hippie grunge.
Exactly. The suits didn't look really 80s. It's like, I don't know. I lived it. And
well,
this fell way short.
I'm fairly confident that a designer was saying, okay, so this is period appropriate. And they're like, okay, well, let's dial this back.
Let's make it all look like the 90s.
They are making a period piece that doesn't look like a period piece.
Yeah.
They are making a period piece that may as well not be a period piece.
Oh,
the only reason it needs to be is because it takes place before Silence of the Lambs.
Mm-hmm.
And they back themselves into that corner.
Yeah. It is a lot of it seems just like... They didn't put forth the effort.
No.
Or they didn't want to go and get things that looked really period. Somebody just went shopping and went, hey, this looks kind of
80s. Went to a thrift store and picked up VHS tapes, and one of them happened to be Mrs. Doubtfire.
Yeah. And somebody who picked it up, you know, hadn't been alive in the year that
Mrs. Doubtfire came out.
That might be a bit extreme. It was less than a decade.
That's true. But still, you know, it was kind of funny to catch something like that. I think it is. It's like just, oh, it's on VHS. It had to be 80s.
Yeah, it was 9 years before. So, yeah, Mrs. Doubtfire was 93. Good Lord.
Yeah.
Yep.
It was a while ago. But, yeah, so when they would pull up with these, you know, the chunky late 80s, that K-car look,
mm-hmm.
you know, with every single vehicle, it was actually kind of jarring to me because it didn't look like anything else really, mm-hmm. really looked like that. And I wanted it to because they were keeping the stylized dialogue, the, you know, everything, you know, from, you know, won't be a tick. And the way Jack talks is very kind of 70s gumshoe.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted it to make sense. I wanted it to seem to fall with the timeline, but it kind of didn't, unfortunately, in a lot of ways. And even the set dressing a lot of the choices that they made. It was like, let me put one real obvious dated thing like VHS tapes, yeah, and nothing else in the room will actually look like it's 80s.
We won't care. No one will care. No one's even paying attention.
No one's paying attention. We'll put some like Laura Ashley kind of looking curtains on there, but it still looks like a modern kitchen.
Edward Norton talking to himself in the tree is just as silly as William Peterson talking to himself in the tree.
And when he finds the little red dragon symbol.
Which Dalarai took the time to color in this version.
He had a lot of time on his hands.
He did. Well, he was just sitting in that tree.
Yeah.
With the cap from a late 90s.
Oh, yeah. You guys pointed that
pop
out.
Pop can.
Yes. Yes. I was like, wait a minute. That's like the pop top. It should have the pull tab. And then I was trying to remember when that changed.
Pick
and I
a
can't
year
remember.
For Christ's sake, Christ movie. Sake.
Exactly. You know, I should have looked that up. I actually don't know
what year
that...
the pop top ended.
Yeah,
it was earlier. Not earlier 80s, but closer to the middle of the decade than the end of.
Yeah, because I'm trying to remember, because I do remember it more as when I was younger, because I remember pulling them off and hooking them together, because people were making like dresses and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Out well, of they them. Still do with the ones they have now, but
and then they decided to just do the pop top where it wasn't a pull tab, it would stay on, but it just seemed to sort of pull me out of like, where are we on this? That seems so I guess we're late 80s. I don't know what we're saying here.
It's miscellaneous
80s.
Let's talk about Francis Dalarai, because we're about there. This gives us a good amount of backstory for him and wastes two tremendous actors.
Wow. We're not bitter, are we?
Well, no. When I heard Ralph Fiennes was being cast as the Red Dragon, that's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
How phenomenal could that be? You know, it's Ralph Fiennes.
Yes.
The man burst on the scene in Schindler's List as one of the most despicable on-screen Nazis you've ever seen, and still, at times, made him likable. Mm-hmm. It was an amazing performance. This is not.
It's underwhelming here.
Mm-hmm. His accent is spotty and weird, and some of that is his performance for his laughable makeup effect on his lip that moves and is so obviously makeup.
Yeah.
There
was a lot. It's so interesting. This entire movie seems to go back and forth between overdone and underdone.
Yeah.
Because I thought that the nursing home sign was overdone.
That chase down the ridiculously long to movie old house?
Yeah, exactly. It was sort of like we're supposed to get that it's a nursing home from all the beds and the wheelchairs I know it's more about backstory line, and I get that you don't want to take the time. Or you think we're too dumb.
No, we're spending way too much time with Hannibal Lecter.
So we can have more time with Hannibal Lecter rather than let the story tell itself. We're just going to put like a big, huge sign on a big stone wall. And I know that this is supposed to be a big house and everything, but I don't know, the way it comes across in the book is that it is a nice-sized house. But it is a house. It's not a mansion.
Right.
It's just kind of like the way they play it in the TV show, where it's just a really nice Victorian house. And this is a woman who found a way to make money quick and cheap and easy, and converted a home into a nursing home. But I don't think she had a long drive with a stately stone, entrance. It seemed really over the top for what this house was supposed to be and what they showed us and everything. So you have this grandiose entrance and this sign, and then you have poor Ralph Fiennes playing it down. And I just felt like, I'm going to beat you over the head with this, but then I'm going to make this so subtle it looks like we're not doing anything. And I think that was my biggest frustration. And that's probably what you're experiencing here. You get Ralph Fiennes, you get Reba, who
and that was
Watson
the most unsubtle blind person introduction.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, Reba would know where he is in the room because we've demonstrated that Reba is good at that. So her handing the film, it's like, by the way, I'm blind.
I totally did a facepalm when she did that because I was just like, really? And that's what it was. It was like, hey, look, if you didn't get it.
By the way, she's blind.
She's blind.
Yeah.
And I thought the same thing. And I'm like, when blind people are talking to people, they actually know where they are.
Yeah.
Like if she was handing it, she may not know exactly where his hand is.
Right. She might fall short of the hand, but she'll know the direction of the body.
Exactly. She would know where the body is.
Yeah.
And if she was uncertain, she would be self-conscious enough to just hold it vaguely out, and he would reach forward.
And it's not like they were pretending that she had recently gone blind. They did discuss that she had gone blind.
She went blind around when she was six or seven. Because we do get the great reference that she saw a cougar before she went blind.
And she wasn't sure if it was real or imagined.
I really like that.
I think it was also hard with her doing her, you know, being blind. So she has these incredibly big, incredibly clear blue eyes, and she kept her eyes really wide open. Like
super forced.
I think that's just Emily Watson.
Oh, you think so? It just seemed...
having seen her before, I think she just
does
got
that
big eyes.
All the time. And it was really distracting because it felt like, again, oh, I'm blind. So I have to stare vacantly off to one thing and my eyes have to be, you know, like wide, wide open where you could see the whites almost entirely around them.
Yeah.
And, you know, having interacted with people who are legally blind, they usually are not. It's more subtle.
And most of the time their eyes track.
Yeah.
Their eyes will track where the person is in the room or where the action is going on in the room, where the discussion is going on in the room. And it felt like she never was doing that.
Yeah.
She didn't have that natural flow to her eye movement.
No, she had a very concentrated, I'm not looking at you. I'm not looking at you because I'm blind.
Yes.
And again, I don't blame the actor because, I mean, she's a tremendous actor.
Oh, yeah.
And it almost feels like maybe she was doing that looking around thing.
And she was told,
hey, you're blind.
Yeah.
Yes. You wouldn't be doing that. Be more blind.
We need more blindness, more. Bigger blindness.
By the way, Brett Ratner, if you're listening and you would like to dispute any of this, please do. Because otherwise, fuck you for really trying hard to ruin Red Dragon.
Because when she, you know, was really in the thick of some great, you know, emotional moments, she was spectacular.
Yeah, she was. Mm-hmm. We have the note on the toilet paper.
Yeah.
I love the code stuff in Red Dragon. It is difficult to film, and especially when you have the dramatic falling out of the toilet paper roll that we got here with the toilet paper note. But the gathering of evidence while we're doing this, we're listening to them talk about what they're doing, and the toilet paper is being taken over and looked at under the thing.
Yeah.
And this is some really good visual storytelling with the guy going down the hallway to
pretend,
Lecter's cage. And you see he doesn't buy it.
Oh, yeah. When he's like, oh, well, that's a place always fun. And it was. They tell him, you know, do this and make, you know, have somebody, you know, grumbling and go down the hallway. And, yeah, it's like he's way too smart.
But Jack Crawford doesn't know what a book code is and needs it explained to him by Lloyd Bowman, the code breaker. I don't think so.
Yeah.
Jack Crawford knows what it is. The audience may not.
Right. There's a lot of unnecessary exposition and explanation in a lot of the things that they do here.
And is Lloyd Bowman going to lose his Library of Congress library card because he's circling stuff in a fucking Library of Congress book?
Yeah, I know.
Are you kidding?
We're like, what? What is going on?
You pointed
there
to something in your notes. What did I miss?
I'm having like trouble tracking where I'm at.
We're all over the place.
Yeah. It was just, when Dollar-Eyed is introduced after the nursing, he's doing his presses and he's got the stocking cap on.
Oh yes.
While he's getting pumped up, then he puts the teeth in.
We don't actually see Dollar-Eyed's face until the scene with Reba. We see the stocking cap, and then we see the half face.
Yeah, and we have like, you know, our Behold the Red Dragon moment, but then they go to the book.
Yeah.
And I just thought it was really interesting.
Big Book of Murder.
In his Big Book of Murder, he had the perfect size spot waiting for that article that was going in there. It was like he knew there was just something too perfect.
It was exactly
this, and then he used the glue stick.
Yeah, the glue stick really irritated me, and it really shouldn't. And I'm trying not to just compare versions, but isn't rubber cement just so much more evocative than a white child's glue stick?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. It fell short and seemed just sort of meh, but it was
meh is exactly how I would describe this film.
Exactly.
This is a two-star film. Two-star films are almost more offensive to me than one-star films, because it's almost like they didn't bother.
Right.
It's like
if they worked harder, it could have been
worse.
We
should just be happy everyone showed up.
Right. Another thing that kind of was a little odd to me is after so everything is perfectly glued on, he's used his glue stick because, you know, he's gotten his school supplies ready for that year. The way he traces Hannibal's face.
I love you.
Yeah.
I love you.
And it is. It's sort of like, oh, it's, you know, like the favorite member of the boy band that he's
Hannibal Lecter teen beat cover.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Does he have posters up in his room of Hannibal above his bed so that when he goes into his bed at night, he can imagine them being together? I understand he's supposed to be a fan, but that kind of took it kind of like the hypersexualized family member where I was like, I don't know if I feel comfortable with that.
Well, and that weird page with all the cutouts of Hannibal's face on it.
Yeah. All the same one, too.
All the same.
So he bought like a whole stack of the same magazine.
For his scrapbook. And my scrapbook. We did get a wonderful scene with angry Chilton taking all of Lecter's stuff away. Mm-hmm. And we get, again, this is a, hey, remember Silence of the Lambs? Remember how awesome that was scene where Lecter is on the dolly with that face plate over his face?
Oh, yeah. You have to do that. I think it's in the contract.
We get both that and the classic Lecter mask because, of course, Philip Seymour Hoffman was fantastic.
Oh my God! Yes.
He plays generic scummy schlubby guy so well, and it's funny because he plays it so well. You initially don't think it's very good,
yeah,
but then you realize exactly what he's doing.
Oh yeah, and I like that it was like he was ill-spoken, slumpy,
yeah,
couldn't look anybody in the eye. Mumbled a lot. And what is like, okay, Phil is doing something here.
Yeah, it's not just he showed up. He's actually performing.
Yeah, this guy needs to be writing for the Tatler. You know what I mean? Like, this is the best he's ever going to be.
I mean, he reminded me a lot of Orson Welles in Touch of Evil. Just like that incredibly unlikable and sort of just like, whatever, I don't fucking care.
Yeah.
Just really, and that's what's so great about Philip Seymour Hoffman is he's not afraid to be unappealing 100%.
Yeah.
And you really see that, right? When he's sitting in that chair glued to it with his gut hanging out and his tighty whities on.
Yes.
I mean, he is the definition of unappealing in that shot. But he's so good because, and when he's talking to the dragon, the moments that really stood out to me was when he thinks there's a little hope and he's like, oh,
but I don't understand.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Let's sure.
Yeah.
And just, you see the hope coming back to him and that's something you can't fake.
Yeah.
And it's Philip Seymour Hoffman has just always been that, well, he's just magnetic and interesting to watch.
His regardless subtleties of what are interesting. Yeah. It winds up not being, it's not deadpan. It's not one thing. He's not going over the top, but he's giving you a lot in what he's doing. And it's true, that whole thing, thankfully, it was. It's like we got to see somebody who was working nuances.
Yeah.
And finding a character in there and putting something there that is a little different. And I liked that it wasn't like a loud, brash, really obnoxious guy, that he was sort of obnoxious in a mumbly way. Mm-hmm. And that he was like somebody you didn't like because of the way he was slumpy and just a mess. And that all the backpedaling and how, oh, I don't want to, you know, I haven't seen your face.
Yeah, the moment he goes into self-preservation mode, he's completely different from the rest of the film. And that's indicative of a good performance. Mm. Unfortunately, in a scene that really requires a great performance, Ralph Fiennes is not bringing it in the do you see scene.
No, there was no intensity there.
No, it's just do you see?
Do you see? Yeah. Because that should be scary.
And Tom Noonan is so wonderful in Manhunter doing that do you see. And Armitage was so great doing. And do you see is intensity and terrifying in the book. And here the only thing he gives that I think is really intense is the you owe me awe thing.
Right.
But everything else is sort of like rushed and weird and unimpressive.
Yeah.
I wrote down rushed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a couple of points where I wrote rushed. Yeah. I feel like that's a common thread throughout this film, is that there are whole clumps of scenes where it just feels like they're just trying to get through it.
And while it's commendable that they're trying to put as much of the book as possible on screen, which they really are.
Yeah.
I mean, don't half-ass it then. Just do it.
Exactly. It's true. It's like there was not enough intensity in the everything from, you know, once we had pulled away from, you know, Phil doing great stuff there, and we go back to Rafe, and being in front of the slides, like when he takes the kimono off, and shows the tattoo.
No blurred ass here.
No. We saw a lot of fine ass,
and a little bit of front. I mean, we didn't get the full Monty, but we got
get the full Rafe.
The full Rafe, no.
We got some side
Rafe.
Profile.
Side
Rafe. There's a little profile going on.
Well,
because he only wraps.
You can't
half
get anything. At least you get some side Rafe.
you did get an awful lot of Hoffman, though.
Yes, you did. Yes, you did.
His tidy whitey bulge was right there.
It was
in
right
your face.
There in your face.
It's true.
In your face.
But then, you know, later on, you also get, a lot of naked Rafe later on.
You do. But I thought that shot in front of the slide projector. I don't know why it irritates me so much. But so we see the white of the slide projector. Maybe that's it. Maybe it's the whitish blue lighting.
Yeah.
But when he turns around and he's got that little grin on his face, it's like, did somebody yell cut before that happened? Was he turning around to ask if that was okay?
That doesn't
look in character. What is that?
It seemed like, I'm the Red Dragon. You get it? Isn't that awesome? Isn't that cool?
I'm the Great Red Dragon.
Isn't that cool? It's awesome, isn't it?
I'm pretty unimpressed by the tattoo as well.
Yeah. I didn't like the tattoo.
It's all black and white tribal.
Tribal, yeah.
It doesn't look like the painting.
No,
it doesn't.
That was something I had a problem with, too, the black and white.
Underwhelming.
Yeah. It didn't really look like he was the dragon. It looked like someone did a very quick
tribal
pen
art.
And ink, tribal art version of it.
Like flash, tattoo flash.
There, exactly. Yeah. And I didn't even like the kimono he wore.
It was very plain, and it looked like a regular robe.
Yeah,
well, you know, exactly. That's because the costume designer said, hey, here's a kimono that his grandmother might have worn, as indicated in the book, which is what we're following. And Brett Ratner's
that's
like,
that's not a female kimono.
No.
Well, he's saying that somebody probably came with
Brett
the correct
Ratner's like,
real one.
Hey, can we do black? Man, I'm thinking black.
Yeah, because what's odd about it.
Or red with a black dragon on it. Can you give me one with a dragon on it?
One of those sad ones that you get in
Chinatown?
And the
costume designer's like, how about black? Let's just go with black.
Because oddly enough, what he's wearing is really a men's kimono.
Yeah.
It's got the men's sleeves are cut and sewn differently than women's are.
So it's definitely not grandma's.
And that's the thing is, it's not grandma's. And the whole idea
is it supposed
that
to be hers?
It's supposed to be you know, the longer sleeve, you know, some kind of bright pattern on it, whatever it is, it's supposed to look like something that wasn't his.
Right.
And in the other movies, it's always been
right.
a beautiful, you know, some kind of thing, kind of, you know, it looks, and having him have that on seems creepier to me.
Yeah.
That transformation, that, and it's important in the book, because there's a point where he actually stops wearing the kimono, and he has, there's a sweatshirt or something, and he throws the sweatjacket on the painting, and mm-hmm. it actually covers the painting for a while. And then when the dragon is talking, which we still don't
get. This movie, no. There was a moment that I think speaking. Was obviously ADR'd because of losing the voice of the dragon.
Yeah.
It's when he says, "I won't give her to you."
Mm-hmm.
He's off screen. And I think the only reason you have that obvious line of dialogue, because Ted Talley is fairly subtle, while the movie is not, the mm-hmm. writer is. The only reason you have that is because you lost the voice of Frank Langella saying, "Give her to me,"
right.
and him saying, "No."
Yeah.
Instead, he says, "I won't give her to you." So you have to fix that. Or you could just leave the voice of the dragon. Why are we afraid of that?
And it's Frank Langella. It couldn't get any more awesome than that. Oh my, yeah. So there was a lot of this great reveal was underwhelming in so many ways with the kimono,
the okay
with the tattoo,
red dragon.
The okay. He's not great.
He's just not
okay.
great. He's fine.
He's fine.
Nah.
He's the average.
The average red
the
dragon.
Meh red dragon. So it's hard to have a definitive scene like this that's important in this storyline. Be so not scary, and then they do all this, and they follow it with that what I call the sunset at Dolaride Mansion shot.
Stately Dolaride Manor.
Dolaride Manor. It was sort of like, why did we need that shot? That was really weird. what like looked like a really like fake sunset happening.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what were they thinking when they were putting this movie together. You know, so yeah.
Money.
Mm-hmm. Money.
Because I'll tell you something. Unlike our favorite television series, this movie made some money.
Yeah. Well, you know, you had some screen time for some amazing people, I guess.
Well, there is a scene where Emily Watson is very good.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the tiger scene.
Oh, yeah.
Though that tiger is incredibly terrifyingly active throughout this scene.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Like terrifying.
Like moving
active.
And
making sounds.
But she's really great in that scene and the scene that follows where she's mapping the house
mm-hmm.
and then telling Dolaride what those at work think because she's got that smile on her face.
I really liked the way she did that.
Yeah.
The way she, you know, tried to reassure him that, you know they don't say the things you think they're saying.
Right.
They actually think you're kind of buff
yeah.
and you're worried about your face and you shouldn't. There was a great like flirtatiousness
mm-hmm.
and the I really want you to know that you're hot.
You're pretty cool. I like you.
Yeah. And it was, I like the way she
this?
Played it. Yeah. We gotta do this.
I know you have some homework to do, which as we talked about during that scene in the show.
Disturbing.
Was him watching the next family. It looked like the next
yes,
family, right?
It's the next family.
Okay.
It's not the
it's
Leeds.
Not the Leeds
it's
or
not the
Jacobis.
No.
Okay. So he's watching his next family
yes.
while Reba makes her... her impulsive blowjob move.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Which we shockingly get less of in this show.
Why did I write heaving boobs?
Because
flames
there's a
on
point,
the side of your face. Heaving.
There's a point where he looks over at her and it's a
oh, yeah,
shot of her chest.
With the camera pans down.
That's
this happens.
What it is. Yeah. It's the profile.
The glorious Panavision widescreen of Emily Watson's
yeah.
chest.
And it's yes. like, and she's... breathing
in the sweater
deeply yeah
it's like why? Ratner's going okay breathe a little bit more no stick them out
yeah
stick them out okay there
they
we
should
go.
Have had them glow like they did in Top Secret.
Like the woman clothed in the sun. I have a single line note here. Grandma looks like James Cromwell.
Yes, you said that and I was like, oh my god, yes. Yes.
The giant portrait of Grandma in the hallway, while may have the voice of Ellen Burstyn, has the face of James
of
Cromwell.
James Cromwell. It was a really it was a creepy grandma painting.
Yeah.
But she needed to be, creepy.
There are so many perplexing things in my notes here. Like, why did we need the voiceover of the lawyer's letter to Will about the things he was sending? This minor Southern lawyer character gets a full voiceover read of the letter he sent to Will, accompanying the effects.
Oh my God, I didn't even.
But we
did
don't
I even
get
write anything about
the Red Dragon voice.
Nope, no dragon, but Byron Metcalf. Lawyer extraordinaire gets a voiceover.
Our Southern lawyer. Another one of those, like, weirdly, I know we're kind of going all over the place because I'm trying to find where Metcalf is in
well,
my
you
notes.
May not have deemed it worthy of
I may
notes.
Not, yeah, for some reason.
It just made me angry.
Yeah, I just know, I wanted to note that after we see James Cromwell, Grandma, and... Rafe is having his moment where he threatens to blow his brains out, that how he figures out that the print, the original, is at the Brooklyn Museum is not that he enters the Brooklyn Museum and we find out that's where the painting is. We have to pan down and find out that
on
this is a cheap museum poster
on his Red Dragon poster.
His Red Dragon poster is a museum poster.
Well, and the best part is that's not how he realizes it, because he's been corresponding with the Brooklyn Museum for months.
So it's useless. All it is that insulting.
It's movie for dummies.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Spoon feeding.
It's not enough, because it's true. They've been talking. It's like he bought it, so obviously he should know that it's from.
He clearly bought it. At the Brooklyn Museum,
or I don't know, maybe he had it mail ordered to him. I don't know.
From the catalog,
exactly.
Because it's the 80s.
Yeah. You can't buy that shit on Amazon at that point and have it. There's no Amazon Prime. It's not going to show up at your house the next
2 days.
No drone's going to deliver it.
You can order your very own Red Dragon print.
Right.
And have it here tomorrow. Motherfucker.
Exactly.
Tomorrow.
No, he had to write for that, write a check. And or a money order. Had to wait 6 to 8 weeks for delivery.
Yeah. But, boy, catalog delivery was not a good time in America.
No, it was. It was a lot of waiting.
I want to talk about two pretty good scenes that are only good because they're basically Silence of the Lambs.
Okay.
Hannibal gives Will the incredibly obtuse Robin Redbreast in a cage puts all of heaven in a rage.
Yes.
Which is a Blake quote. Which Will has to then go to a bookstore to look up,
Yeah.
But it's very much like the yourself storage thing. It's one of those Hannibalisms that's just like, well, why would he tell me that?
Yeah.
Maybe it
means something. Out of all the things he said,
yes.
That one thing apparently means something.
But I also like the way Hannibal requests his dinner and a show is very much like, I want a place with a view. Maybe you see a river, water.
But you have to hear Anthony Hopkins say that.
Oh, and this is why it's wonderful. Yeah. This is why it's worth seeing this movie only for Anthony Hopkins. We should cut Anthony Hopkins into Manhunter. But poor Brian Cox, who is perfectly serviceable.
Exactly. I still love Brian Cox. But I have to say, though, Hopkins' Hannibal is so creepy in a wonderfully delicious way. Just the what he does with his eyes and what he does with his face and the inflection of his voice and that oddly continental Atlantic accent that
he
has.
His accent was inspired by Katharine Hepburn.
Interesting.
That is what Anthony Hopkins has. And Hal. He basically combined Hal 9000 and Katharine Hepburn. And that's the voice of
Hannibal Lecter. Completely makes sense why... It's mesmerizing. It makes you uncomfortable, but you can't stop listening to it. And his presence is creepy. Even though they do a lot of, cheap jump scares where he's tethered. He feels the rush of panic. Yeah, exactly.
It's he's 3 feet away from you. Why are you panicking? What is going on?
He's on a freaking leash. What?
Are you behind the line that says do not cross this line?
Then I think you're fine.
Come on, Will Graham. You're supposed to be this badass guy.
Right. And then we get to do the walk and talk while he's on a leash. Yes. Like he's in a dog run or something.
It's the West Wing.
Right. I have to do a walk and talk. I know. We'll put him on a leash. And there is a point here where there's a jump scare. I don't even know what it is. I went, oh, jump scare. Thank you.
We all had that ooh jump scare thank you moment. We had the movie Sin racking the shotgun for absolutely no reason.
Yes, why do people still do that? It's like, yeah, let's waste a shell by racking the
Lecter scaring the waiter. I thought was delightful. The guy who's serving him soup and he looks up and Lecter's right there and he goes, thank you. And he gets to taunt Chilton with his little toast to the camera, and Chilton's just watching him furious. Barney, thrilled.
Yes.
Thinks it's hilarious.
We get the incredibly silly eating of the painting.
Yes.
Incredibly silly here. And you pointed out that the woman presenting the painting is not wearing gloves.
Yep. I totally wrote not wearing gloves.
Just like later when Will looks through the big book of murder, he's not wearing gloves.
Yeah.
If you're dealing...
handle evidence.
And that's something about things.
Except when you're the guy who's hired to pretend you're the janitor to fool Dr. Lecter. You wear gloves and then you leave them hanging out of your pocket because you're an idiot.
So it's going to be really noticeable. But yeah, just like you wouldn't, you know, disturb evidence.
Yeah.
When you're dealing with archived objects, you always wear gloves.
Mm-hmm.
And I get that she opens up the box and she actually doesn't touch the item. But I would think that if she was going to present it to him, that you would have, you know.
She does touch the plastic sheet.
Yeah. And that's the thing. It's like you would want to not put the oils from your fingers anywhere on the box, especially something that is so well preserved and is that old. You know, usually archivists, the first thing they do is put the cotton gloves on. So it was kind of weird to me. It was like, why did she not? She touched the. I understand that it's in, you know,
what's wrong with you?
Plastic, but
well, don't worry. It was just one of those posters, and they cut the Brooklyn Museum.
Yeah,
made it easier for him to digest.
Yeah, much easier.
But it was like the way he tore it, and then he's interrupted, which is more in line with
It's just so silly. I mean, it's a really silly scene.
Yeah. And then I'm like, did he finish eating the painting? Because she came in? Did he shove the rest of it in? Did he leave it there? Should the next line not be he ate a painting? Should it be he ate part of a painting?
Well, later it'll be displayed as just the bottom part of it.
An artist rendering of what the rest of it looks like.
Well, they can use the posters. It's just the bottom part. This is the actual painting before most of it got eaten by a psychopath.
And the way he gets out in the book, it's thought out. You know, he has the guitar case, and he has a way of getting out of there without being noticed. It's kind of, you know, almost Bond-esque.
This is incredibly impulsive.
Exactly. You know, that he goes out and he's got the paper sack, like he's gone grocery shopping. He winds up, has a tracksuit on, like shorts and a running suit under his suit. He takes all of that out, puts it in the guitar case and leaves it. And basically walks off.
And then he's a different person.
With a guy who looks like he's been running and is carrying a paper sack from a grocery store with, like, I think he puts like a baguette. It's like a lettuce or a piece of lettuce or something like that is sticking out the top.
Because really, no grocery bag can be complete without a
baguette.
It
has to have the
baguette out of it.
Exactly. I have been guilty of that. of putting, it's usually. Like a head of green leaf lettuce and the baguette.
And the baguette
it fills it rather
it does. It's
nicely.
Nice. Yeah.
And it looks like groceries. But yeah, it's like where it looks like he really planned it and he really planned his exit, other than this dragon who just walks out and we're done.
Desperate.
Yeah.
Yeah. We do have a really nicely done scene here where Dollar-Eyed goes to the office and follows that employee in. And sees Will Graham there. I thought that was really nice and subtle.
Mm-hmm.
And then that leads to poor Frank Whaley
Aw.
You know,
Ralph.
Basically, the dragon says, say what again? Say what again, motherfucker?
Say what? One more time.
Goddamn time. And then just shoots Ralph and takes Reba.
Yeah.
I will say, the ruse is far less telegraphed here. Mm-hmm. There was no moment, this may be because I've seen this twice now, but there was no moment in the Hannibal version where it didn't seem like a ruse that him shooting himself in the head.
And
maybe it's because they went over the key and you remember how to get here and you know how to get. Maybe it was that
they spent more time with that.
Yeah.
This here, it's again, like Ophelia was saying, it's rushed.
Yeah.
We don't really, we've already established because we've seen Ralph Mandy already. This is not the first time he's wearing that lovely tracksuit the first time we see him. That looks like he's like a porn star, 70s porn star, not really like, but I know they're trying to make him look smarmy and maybe not the guy at the office you want to date, but he's still going to go after every chick in the office.
But don't worry, he's going on vacation today.
Today.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Nobody else miss me.
No one will miss me, especially in his like incredibly rad members only jacket.
Yeah. Well, you know it was the 80s.
You have to. I saw that and I was like, hey, members only jacket.
All right.
If you're going to do 80s. Gotta have the members only jacket.
Wait a period movie.
Right. If you're gonna period, you period like that.
Wow.
Another super unsubtle moment. Reba knows where the clock is because it's conveniently 10 o'clock.
Was that
like, and is chiming.
And is chiming.
At the moment.
It should have, it was enough that it's just ticking. Mm-hmm. We don't, again, at times not working enough. And at times working too hard.
My favorite moment watching this was you saying, oh, hell no, when the house exploded.
Yes.
Yeah.
I have notes. I have notes.
I love it. I have notes.
I have thoughts.
Yeah, because we do. We skip the whole van thing. Yeah. We don't see any. They're just there.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of stuff that happens in the house, again, rushed. We don't really get into how he's faked it about the whole thing with the key, and just like sort of wakes her up and goes right into the feeling of the gun. It leaves a lot of stuff out. Just rushes into it and then throws some gas down.
Just kicks it over. Just here and there. Yeah.
Yeah. So please share your notes because I'm sure it's like everything I hated about this scene.
Well, I mean, my notes basically are
houses do not work that way.
I mean, it's
it also blew it's up from the second floor.
Yes. Yes.
Like, so whatever is explosive in the house is being kept upstairs.
Yes. Like the upstairs was lined with C4. Mm-hmm. It's my big pet peeve with cars that explode in movies, and it's even worse because this is a house. It's a house. I mean, what do you store in your house
his gas tank that powers his house.
Oh,
I guess if they had given some kind of idea that he'd been preparing for this.
At least the safe that contained the book didn't fly through the air and land at Will Graham's feet.
Exactly. Yeah. And then the book falls out.
Yeah. The door
the safe opens
up,
and the
Indiana
book falls
Jones
out.
Tumbles out, and then the book.
Actually, I was disappointed that when the house exploded, they weren't running in slow-mo.
No.
You know, and the thing explodes.
Like slow.
So, and then they like fall towards
and
the camera.
Pieces are shooting.
And Will Graham, he looks at it with squinty eyes as the fire is
exactly.
The lighting on his face. Yeah.
Yeah. There is like so much cliche that was done. And it was.
Movie for you guys.
Yeah.
Here's some movie.
Now, if they wanted us to believe that he had set the house up to, you know, burn in such a way that no evidence inside would be usable, then they should have, like you said, sort of set it up to see that he had put something explosive or added more
gasoline.
Or, but even so, that's not how
that's
things
not the
burn.
Kind of explosion. Yeah,
that's a C4 explosion. Mm-hmm. That is what they've done is they did dynamite stuff.
It's very. It seems very much the typical director. I'll make it bigger.
Yeah,
you wanted an explosive finish.
Yeah, it's got to be bigger.
Houses can burn hot and fast without exploding.
Yeah.
Especially when the room with the evidence you really want to keep.
It burns down.
Well, the room with the evidence is completely filled with gasoline.
Yes.
That room is going to burn. The second floor of the house doesn't need to explode.
Yeah.
No, it doesn't.
You just need to burn, you know, poor Smarmy Mandy enough to look like he could be anybody.
Yeah.
You don't really need to. And I'm trying to remember in the book if it explodes.
I'm sure there is not a line in Thomas's Harris's work saying
Thomas's
the house, the house exploded.
No, it doesn't.
I'd have to, because I really don't remember. I know that
as Will Graham looks on.
I know that it's a tremendous fire.
Yeah.
But I can't remember if there's any notes in there.
Well, I believe they arrived later because Reba was just sort of wandering.
Yeah. Because I think they're driving to it and they see the fire in the distance.
Yes.
Yes,
and that's when they're like, oh, that must be where it is.
Yes, that is what happens.
And they get there and it's true. She's been wandering for a while when they find her.
Can we talk about the horrible exchange in the hospital?
Yes, where Will gets all the good lines.
Horrible.
Like they take all the lines and give them to Will.
He is
douchebag.
Yeah,
I actually wrote
major douche. Talking about her hair.
I wrote Will is the Fonz. I don't know why I wrote that, but I think when you're talking about you mentioned
worse than
that he's like a douchebag.
Douchey McDouchebag.
That was
no,
like,
you're awesome except for your hair.
Yeah.
No, that's terrible.
Fix that before I come back.
I hated that bastard line.
This guy is a dick.
I hated that.
I mean,
that he made fun of her hair and fixed that one.
There was a lot of, I don't know, I guess misogyny that I kind of picked up on in that exchange.
Yeah.
He delivers all the lines himself. And it's supposed
all
to be a witty banter.
Yeah. The you didn't draw a freak. I was so upset.
Yeah.
That he said that. It's just like out of, you know, it's almost apropos of nothing. You didn't draw a freak. You drew a man with a freak on his back.
Yeah. It's a very tender exchange.
Terrible.
Yeah. It's even written that way in the book.
It's just
so why
butchered.
Make him into this like asshole?
I don't know.
At a time
because he's cool. That's really what this movie is telling us, is that Will
Graham is super
cool.
But you know what? There was no way you could make Edward Norton cool in this movie.
Not in this movie.
No. He looked like some teenager.
Edward Norton did this movie for a paycheck, and that paycheck paid for the 25th hour. That is why Edward Norton is in this movie, period.
Well, and it comes across in his performance, unfortunately.
At the end of every scene, it's just like, okay, I got to go pick up my check.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was their exchange was so disappointing for me, and that made me very uncomfortable.
Ruined it
when he said that. And again, it was like, why add that? Why put that in?
I don't know. It did seem.
And why does her hair look so much worse at the hospital than it did outside the
after the explosion?
Yeah. Maybe she's been pulling at it. I don't know.
Yeah.
Why am I in this movie?
So really what you're saying is that was just Emily Watson's moment of clarity.
Of clarity.
What am I doing?
This is her rock bottom.
Yeah.
Like, she woke up in that hospital and be like, oh, shit.
Wow, did I really just do this?
People are going to see this.
Oh, no.
Oh, my God.
Do you feel like you need to get away?
Yeah.
To prove even more that Will is cool guy, he gets to have a heartfelt moment with Molly about how he feels sorry for Dolaride.
Because he's just a monster.
Because he read the Big Book of Murder.
The Big Book of Murder with all the stories about how he was abused.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, this guy really likes Hannibal Lecter. Yeah.
Yeah, it took me an entire movie to figure that out.
And he did not like the word tooth fairy.
No.
He had a real problem with people calling him a tooth fairy.
He marked that out with a red marker.
But you know what's funny? Will is just as much a douchebag about his son. In this scene, because he sends his son in to get stuff. He's like, what's taking him so long?
I want marshmallows. I want marshmallows now.
Yeah, he was like a real dick at the end of this movie.
He is not likable at all in the last
few scenes. We need him to be likable.
Yes.
And if I can't say it enough, in the books, we feel for them.
We can definitely compare without question to the books. It is a film adaptation's job to at least adapt the core of a book. You don't have to adapt everything, but you have to adapt tonally what the book is.
Exactly.
Unless you're Charlie Kaufman, and then you can just do whatever the fuck you want.
Exactly. But here, I think it's at a disservice.
Oh, yeah.
Because Will's transformation isn't from a hard-boiled detective to douchebag during the course of this film.
Are you sure? Because I think that's his character arc.
He even has frosted-tipped hair. Like, yeah, I don't know if anybody noticed.
Hair got weird.
The blonde.
The idea is
that he spends a lot of time in the
salon. I don't care what the idea is. He looks like he spends a lot of time in a salon.
He looks like Affleck in Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back.
Look at these two morose motherfuckers right here.
So what you're saying is that Will has been going out.
It's like, Will, get out of the salon and get back into your
house. He's been spraying sun in his hair.
Yes, yes.
To get that frosted. Spray sun.
I could see him with like the reflective screen laying down.
Yeah.
I don't know. Sun in was big in the 90s.
Yeah. That was around for a long time.
Probably.
Yeah, from like the 70s.
All
on.
Of the eras this film spans.
So it is. It works well. It
rolls them all into one.
To do Sun.
Including the 2000s.
I don't know. I guess he just looked more of like the surfer dude than the guy who works on boats.
That's what's so much so offensive about this version of the character is he is not damaged in any way.
No.
He is not affected by the murder she's seeing or the fact that he gets gutted at the beginning
of
the movie.
He's disaffected when he's walking through the crime scenes.
Yeah.
Like, not just disaffected that he's seen a lot of murder. He's disaffected when he's being faced with the evidence of something horrific. He's just like, meh, whatever.
Yeah, all the blood and the way he's looking at the bloodstains on the wall. Yeah. It was sort of like, it was too clinical. It was too disconnected from the scene.
Yeah.
And the whole idea is that Will is so connected.
And tortured by this connection of between him and the serial killers. Mm-hmm. Like, tortured by the fact that he can get into their minds.
Yeah.
And that it's supposed to be this inner turmoil, and he's freaked out by his own abilities, and you don't get any of that. I mean
this is white bread walking through this. Yeah. that's all he is. He is just generic.
And so
cop.
At the end you don't get the culmination of all of that, of having to go back and talk to the person who stabbed him and who did horrific things while he
something
was trying to...
so terrible that he quit.
Yes. Exactly.
He looks like a guy who went on a 2-week vacation.
And was put away for a while.
Yeah.
Like, actually had to go to a mental institution
afterwards.
Because they do talk about that, right?
It's one of the newspaper montages.
Yeah, the montage.
Right. They don't talk about it.
He's like a loony man.
Yeah. I forgot what it was.
Yeah.
I forgot the headline, but
there's a couple of headlines where they talk about him going in to the mental facility because they use, all that. Loony bin and things like that. But that's the only time they really talk about it.
Right.
Because it's
unimportant for the character. That title sequence actually tells a better story than the rest of this movie.
Exactly.
Because that title sequence tells a compelling, cohesive story.
Yeah.
It really does.
And then they don't give us a very good relationship between Will and Molly.
No, it's all surface.
Yeah, they don't give a talented actress a whole lot to do. She spends a lot of time just sort of like fretting and biting her nails. And I'm like, this is someone who is actually capable of so much more than this, so much more depth, and all she's doing is being pacey and fretty, sort of fretting, not really expressing how this is going to damage their relationship,
right.
How she's going to deal with his absence, the intensity of what's going to happen, not even how much she hates Jack is coming across.
Yeah, I mean, she makes a comment, but it's so underwhelming.
It's very flippant
The scene doesn't matter.
And then the fact that they do that hippie thing with her, and it's just about her being in this tank in the little halter dress and the torn up jeans. They don't give her any meatiness to her place in this whole story. She's not there just to conveniently be there to do a jump scare at the end of the movie.
She's not even super convincing with the defense of her son.
Like,
no.
That came across in
Well, all she does is sit up in bed when she hears the prowler outside her house.
Right.
Yeah.
She sits up until the FBI lights shine in her window and, oh, we have to get you out of here.
Oh, it's a helicopter.
Yeah. Yeah. They don't give, yeah, she doesn't.
They don't even give us a moment of suspense where we think it's him.
Right.
Right. Right. It's like maybe 5 seconds or something before
sits
we
up,
get
kid comes in. Okay. It helicopter. Wasn't the prowler. It was the kid. Oh, then the helicopter. Then I guess the FBI's.
Yeah.
Yeah. They lost a lot of opportunity.
There was no tension.
Yeah. And there really should have been at the end here. And even with Dollaride being in the house.
The only tension is, why didn't Will tell Molly Dollaride was coming out, was there?
It's true.
Why? Why isn't he yelling that immediately? Bring
He's
your gun.
Upstairs.
He's up here.
Yeah. Maybe he thought by
get
being quiet.
He wasn't going to accelerate.
Well,
see, the thing
is if
he yelled at Molly to do that, I don't think Dollaride would have gone to get her. He would have gone to the source of the yelling to shut up the yelling.
Yeah, it did seem kind of odd, like that whole sequence on the top.
It doesn't make any sense. The
way it played out was just terrible, scrambled.
And then you just go ahead
no
and
sense.
Yell at your son for peeing in his pants. You know what? I don't care that that's your gambit. I don't care. That kid is going to be more traumatized by what his dad said to him than by the serial killer holding
a gun.
What they were trying to play there is that the boy will understand.
Oh, I know what they were trying to do.
That he wasn't actually, that he didn't mean it. That it was, you know, that this was trying to trigger a reaction from the serial killer because the serial killer's grandmother was abusive. So I kind of get what they, how they were trying to play that so that we didn't hate him for doing it. But it was. And it was interesting that he would do it to the boy and not to Dollar. And I really think it doesn't serve the character of Dollaride at this point because if he's had his becoming,
yes,
and he has the power of the Great Red Dragon, would he really be affected by Will talking like his grandmother?
You know what it is? It's that weird moment in Friday the 13th Part 2 where the girl convinces Jason that she's his mother.
Oh, yeah.
But Jason only fell for it for a moment.
For a moment, yeah. Apparently, Francis is...
And then the even weirder moment in Friday the 13th Part 4, where Corey Feldman convinces Jason that he's Jason.
Wow. Well, you know, once you get to 4,
things get a little diluted.
Throwing a whole lot of stuff out the window.
But I feel like too part of what fails in this scene is that he doesn't stick with the dialogue of the grandmother.
Yeah.
But we know that,
he does the cut it off thing.
First of all, we don't know that Will should even have that knowledge.
In fact, he probably should.
Well, that's
he probably
what shouldn't. Really bothers me about it, is that he wouldn't know all that.
Yeah.
But he takes it way too far. I mean, with the use of the words that he chooses and he takes it way beyond. I think that you could see that Dollaride was affected early on in him yelling at his son for peeing his pants. But he just kept going and going and going. I think he already like kind of pulled the glass away. So I feel like the scene kind of just kept going.
It goes on
even,
too long.
Even though it didn't need to progress any
ugly.
Farther.
Yeah,
and it did.
And uncomfortable.
It got to a point where like, okay, we see what you're doing. You're trying to use his bad memories of his grandmother
against him, yeah.
And you want him to sympathize with the son so that
he doesn't hurt
the son, but he comes after Will instead. He wants to make himself the demon, but I feel like he's succeeded in doing that a minute before the scene continues. And it's just,
it's
too much.
What it comes down to is the original ending was fine for everybody else.
It was. Mm. Except for Manhunter.
Yeah.
Or Hannibal the series. Really, it was fine for only Thomas Harris.
Only Thomas Harris.
But nobody
and
else.
And for all the readers who loved it.
Yeah, nobody else went this far off track, is what I'm saying. Everyone
else
kind of still went down that. I mean, the series had painted itself into a corner.
Yeah.
So because they had certain things that already happened and they couldn't have happened again.
Well, and Manhunter has Dollaride just kill himself when he supposedly blows his head. I have no idea. I don't remember. We'll have to have watched that before last week's episode.
Exactly, which we have not done yet in the timey-wimey time. I got halfway through it, and I haven't rewatched the end yet, so I'm trying to remember.
Will kills Dollaride.
Yeah.
But I know he... I don't know.
But it's not... They don't feel the need to use a terrible device like this.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's still an action sequence with Dollaride.
With Inagata DeVita.
Exactly. And... You know, and Dollaride is, they're able to overcome him without using something weird like this thing with the kid.
Yeah.
It all sort of makes sense. They take what they need from that scene. You know, Molly doesn't really get her moment of glory, but it still sort of makes sense.
She does a triple tap, though.
Yeah.
she does.
Yeah.
Pow, pow, pow.
Yeah, it shoots him in the side of the face, which I liked. When he gets the bullet in the cheek, that was kind of cool.
But it's like, now if she's going to get her moment of glory,
then she breaks down into standard cliche crying fit.
Yeah,
like I killed him, but oh,
I would have much rather have had a tumultuous scene battling the dragon. And then here comes Molly and just blows him away. It has to have that moment of where she's not told to by Will.
Yeah.
You know, there's no other scene with the, there's nothing else other than her realizing he's going to die if I don't just do something right now, and having to overcome whatever fear she has or reservations
about taking a life.
Exactly. Cause that moment of doing that is not easy for someone who's not a law enforcement officer.
Right, and you've never really contemplated. But that's the other thing. She has contemplated.
Mm-hmm.
They show us in this movie where she's shooting and learning to shoot a gun. So it's not like it's a foreign concept. She probably has thought about, what am I going to do if he comes after my family?
Yeah, I'm going to have to defend myself.
I would think that this decision wouldn't take as long. Mm-hmm. For her to make.
Yeah.
But, or I think it wouldn't destroy her the way it does.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, no, I think you're right. And that would have happened if the characters had been better developed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or the director thought about it at all.
At all.
I don't know. At all.
Or understood what was going on.
Like, she can be affected by it. She can be, she could be tearing up, but not sobbing uncontrollably as though this is completely foreign to her.
And I think it took
my
the strength
God,
away
what have
from
I
her.
Done?
Yeah.
Like, I think she should be stunned and shocked the way that our other Molly was.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that she should be a blubbering mess.
Yeah. There was a lot of that, exactly. I think that she may have been later on. When she's not in
when
shock.
Things
you know, trauma,
sink
yeah.
Because that is how shock works.
Yeah.
Shock actually shuts down your emotions because it is not in your best interest in the fight or flight reaction for you to get all emotional.
Right.
Like
this is one of those great moments where she should have just kept
clicking the gun was
even
dead.
When it's not shooting, just kept clicking it and then just drop it and be shocked.
Yeah.
That's a powerful character moment.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe go to Will, who's been shot.
Yeah.
Instead of collapsing on the floor. How about you take care of the fucking house?
I know.
Because that is how your brain would work. You get the heightened sense of adrenaline and you deal with the situation. You kill Dollarhide. Then you realize, okay, I still have two other people in this house. I'm
going to
make
sure
my son is okay.
Yeah.
My son's okay. That's fine. Okay.
Poor kid peed himself and got yelled at by his dad.
Yeah.
And called a bad name.
Yeah.
And then you see the other person who's been shot. You take care of the person who's been shot. That
you process later.
Right. You
go
break down later.
Mode.
Except for in Movie for Dummies mode, where we need the processing now because it's a more dramatic part for a woman.
So we're just going to let the guy who's been shot bleed out.
Collapse into tears.
Because she's a woman.
Yeah.
What do you expect, ladies?
Wow. Don't you dare take that tone with me.
This little playlet was me being Brett Ratner, by the way.
Okay. Well,
apparently Brett Ratner
really don't like Brett
Ratner.
He was directing me. Yeah. I wasn't very good, was I?
A little underwhelming there.
That's how you know he was directing.
Well played.
Fully committed.
Because I was, I really half-assed it.
Oh, please.
So Will and Molly sail away.
Oh, my God. This was so bad.
While we get Hannibal's letter.
It reminded me of, was it Bad Things? Wild Things? Oh, my goodness.
Wild Things?
Was it Wild Things?
Wild Things is the one where in the credits, like, they give you all sorts of new information about the movie.
New information about
the movie? Yeah, because the whole movie's like this mystery puzzle box, and then you learn, like, half of what actually was happening in the closing credits.
Oh, I don't remember that movie at all.
I just remember the end, they sail away.
She kills the guy off the boat,
and she sails away. Anyway. That's just what it reminded me of.
But we get Hannibal's letter, where we get the wonderful line, I hope you're not too,
too ugly.
And never forget who gave you the best of your scars. Mm-hmm. That's lovely. But why did he say, do you dream much, Will? Because he said that earlier in the film.
Yeah. Three times. I believe it was three times.
See, I know at least twice.
I think he said it when they first meet, mm-hmm. when Will first comes to him. Then he says it again when Will... comes to see him about, I think, the second time he gets advice, mm-hmm. and then they say it again here. I could be wrong.
Yeah.
Somebody can correct
me.
Well,
I feel like it was three times. It was in the first scene with Lecter because that's the line that made William Peterson's Will Graham bolt out of the asylum and run down that awesome Getty staircase. But here it doesn't make any sense.
No.
There, it's Lecter goading Will. It's like, hey, remember when you used to have nightmares because you do this thing that fucks you up?
Yeah.
Do you dream much now?
Exactly.
Do you dream because you're coming to see me? Do you dream about the time I penetrated you?
Whoa, penetrated you.
Anyway.
Totally did.
He did.
Got right up in close.
Roughly.
Most roughly.
Okay.
He did.
He derailed me.
You're thinking about Dr. Lecter penetrating Will? It doesn't have to be this Dr. Lecter penetrating this Will.
No, we don't want to think about this Dr. Lecter penetrating this Will.
No, the dreams and being tortured. One of the things that I thought was pretty impressive about Manhunter and in the book, maybe not impressive, but I feel like told a lot about this tortured inner soul of Will, was waking up next to Mrs. Leeds in bed.
Yes.
Yeah.
And... honestly, I don't think it could have saved this movie. They could have thrown that in there, and I still wouldn't have been convinced.
Because it would have done half-assed.
I still wouldn't have been convinced that this Will Graham is...
Heaving boobs.
Heaving bloody boobs. That is the version of this scene, that scene that you want, that you're glad that they didn't
do. I'm glad
do
they
it.
Didn't do it, especially if they did it that way.
Heaving
but
bloody
I feel
boobs.
Like even if they had thrown that in there, I still wouldn't have been convinced that this Will Graham is tortured by his dreams.
Yeah.
So it's even extra out of place that Hannibal would mention dreams.
He's not
when
tortured
they don't
by anything.
Show him being tortured by dreams.
Right.
No, they didn't do that at all. He didn't seem tortured about anything.
No.
No.
That none of this was really had any, it didn't have any consequence. It didn't have, you know, that really did bother me because I think that's so essential.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what this character.
That's what Will Graham is supposed to be.
Between Will Graham and every other investigator.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That is what makes...
He's supposed to be different than any other cop. He's supposed to be different than any other detective.
Well, no, I mean, I'm talking character-wise. That's, you know, Francis Dolarhyde being well explored is really great character-wise. Mm. But what makes Red Dragon different is the character of Will Graham is not like any other character in this genre.
In the genre.
He just isn't.
Yeah. He's not the average gumshoe guy that comes in and just happens to have, you know, a great skill at
and
detecting.
And he's certainly not exactly what Edward Norton portrays, which is like every other detective that was in that era.
And the fact that he's so flawed.
Yeah.
Yet so geniusly good at what he does, that sort of that dichotomy.
So good he notices that there might have been a dog.
Yeah.
From just the clues of a dog bed, a picture of the family with the dog, and a dog house in the yard.
Yeah. They didn't really address some of the things that he thought of.
No.
You know, like, well, what about this? Or, you know, talking about the way he talked about the bolt cutter.
Mm-hmm.
And the way he kept like trying to figure it out, that's like magical when they do it, where he's sitting there and he's trying to figure out, well, how do they know? And he goes through the whole process of really, well, you know, the seller, It's you know, that had a bolt. It's different. It's a different cellar door. They really undersold that.
Yeah. It took a long time for him to come to that conclusion. It should have taken less time.
Yeah.
Considering he's sitting there watching the video. But,
where there's a deadbolt.
Yeah. It did. It
and it showed it to the audience.
Yeah.
Like, hey, look over here. This basement door has a deadbolt.
Yeah.
And now they're talking about why he brought big giant. Hey, you guys. Do you guys understand now?
Movie for dummies.
Now Will Graham's gonna get it.
Yeah.
I want to make sure you guys got it first.
There was a lot of that. They did. They did a lot of, let me show it to you. Hey, check it out. Check it out.
And that's Brett Ratner sitting in the seat next to us saying,
that's why he brought the bolt cutter.
Did you see that? Watch this part.
This is so cool.
This is important. You should pay attention.
Yeah.
And they do. And that's the thing. If the audience is being shown the evidence before the special agent gets it.
Yeah, we should not get it immediately.
No, we shouldn't get it first.
So we're not sitting there yelling at the screen, look at the bolt, look at the cellar.
He should be 10 steps ahead of us, not one step behind.
It should be when he says that, we're like, oh, I didn't even see that.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. It should be something that we have to go back and be like, hey, we should rewatch that scene because I think we missed something.
Right.
Yeah, and a copy of Mrs. Doubtfire. They must be from the future.
Sure. He's a time traveler.
Both families are from the future.
Is there a DeLorean around?
That's
somewhere?
What they have in Well, it was the 80s.
It was the 80s.
Yeah.
So they know, DeLorean.
Should be a DeLorean.
A DeLorean. It's in the shop all the time. But they own one.
Was it 88 miles an hour?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's talk about the Nick Fury moment in this movie.
The Nick Fury moment.
Yeah, I don't know what you're talking
about. Let's tie the series together.
You know, and it's funny because I was going to say that. I was like, we're talking about, you know, hey, look at this. You get it? You get it?
You get it? There's another movie coming up that's called Silence of the Lambs.
The offensive moment of that was the end of this film.
Oh, now I know what you're saying. Okay. Nick Fury moment. What are you talking about Nick Fury for?
No, the end of the credits.
Yes. Okay.
Here's my, you know. There's a lot of problems with this scene. I'm going to let you talk about how offensive it is. But I have an issue with the fact that Chilton appears to have come all the way downstairs to Hannibal Lecter's cell to say, I'm going to just send this girl away, to then go all the way back upstairs to see Clarice and have that great conversation with Clarice, to then take Clarice all the way downstairs to be told not to come in and see Hannibal. I don't believe that for
at
a
all.
Second.
It's cheap. This was really, really
cheap.
And I was insulted.
The end of my notes actually says, overall feels cheap and hurried. Those are my notes.
The ending,
and
I
that applies for the whole film.
Yeah, pretty much.
Because it was. There was a lot of cheap gags, a lot of cheap.
I have that in the sidelines in several places. Mm.
And I thought this ending was cheap, and I think it sort of undervalued the audience.
Yeah.
We know what's coming next. We know.
Well, really, the reason why we're watching this movie
is because of what's coming next.
Came next.
Well, you don't want to reference a better film in your film. Right. This movie falls prey to that sin so much.
Look how far we've fallen.
Yeah. And then, you know, like, the story should just bookend each other with an indeterminate amount of time in between.
No, but instead, it's moments.
It's like, let's bring it all
the
way up.
It's literally Will has been kicked to the curb.
Yeah.
He's, you know, off sailing the ocean blue, whatever it is. Everybody's cool.
He's gonna go to Italy and solve mysteries.
Right, exactly. He's going to be the bumbling
detective. With
Inspector
Rinaldo Pazzi.
In Italy. And...
Or the bumbling, you think he's going to become Clouseau.
Clouseau. In this movie?
That's not too far.
No, Edward Norton could not pull off Clouseau.
He couldn't pull off.
Too douchey?
Too many reasons.
But to then basically like lead up to, okay, we've just finished this, and now we're going to go straight into...
Yeah.
Clarice is there.
So here, go get your copy of Silence of the Lambs and just put it on because it'll flow seamlessly.
Exactly. And I don't know why that
And you'll never know
me.
How bad this movie was.
I mean, even...
Yeah, maybe you'll have forgotten by the time you finish Silence of the Lambs.
Because you'll be like, wow, Silence of the Lambs is so great.
So we can end with, you know, 12-year, actually, it's like 22 or something like that when you add how the differences between the movies of how old Lecter is, you know, to where he is in the next movie.
Definitely tell the difference now.
It's like, oh, let's have a really, like a close-up and an intense thing, and then just lead right into the other movie that happened like 11 years earlier. And
what's her name?
Yeah.
I mean...
Oh, yeah. Why?
Why does Hannibal Lecter care about a name?
Yes.
Yes.
Hannibal Lecter would never care about something
that's
so trite.
So bothered me. It really did. Why would he ask?
He wouldn't care.
I mean, really.
And it wouldn't change his mind.
That that whole scene is only there. So in middle America, some guy just went to his date. It's Clarice.
Exactly. That's
it's
what
Clarice.
I was saying. It's one of those
oh my God.
Elbow, like, oh my God, I figured it out.
It's basically so sitting next to Brett Ratner. He wanted you to be Brett Ratner on the way home. It's like, you remember that part where it's Clarice is going to be extreme?
Come
my
on,
God.
You know it's
Let's
Clarice.
Go home and watch Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah. Let's go buy it.
Let's go buy it.
Let's go.
Oh, dear.
Just think of when this comes out on VHS. We can watch them back to back.
Back to back. We'll play Dark Side of the Moon at the same time.
So,
see if
yeah.
anything syncs up.
That's Red Dragon.
Yep.
Yeah.
It is, I will say, worse than I remember it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't remember seeing this movie. And I said at the beginning, I was like, either I don't remember seeing it, because it was
out?
So bad and I blocked it out, or I actually haven't seen it. I couldn't tell the difference. I didn't know if I've suppressed this or if I'd seen it.
It's not suppression, but
it's so damaging.
Well, it is
memory.
To somebody who's a fan of the series.
Well, I like
or a
and,
fan
and
of
the books.
Filmmaking.
Again, I
and yes, exactly.
Honestly, I think
exactly.
what it is I repressed
don't have to be a
everything
fan of Thomas
that
Harris.
Anthony Hopkins wasn't in.
Ah.
So I basically remember this awesome preview that only has Hannibal Lecter in it.
So really, the best Red Dragon for you would just be all other scenes edited out and just all of Anthony Hopkins scenes back to back.
Just back to back.
Just back to back.
Yeah.
Even the one with the ponytail?
Well, you know, it just makes me think of how amazing Jack Nicholson's ponytail is in The Witches
of Eastwick.
Because, you know, nothing on earth says scummier douchebag than slick back hair
and
a ponytail.
That's true.
Nothing.
Yeah.
Edward Norton can't out-douche that ponytail.
No amount of sun in or frosted tips.
No. Whoa. No. That ponytail is the most offensive thing in the movie.
It is. And it's sad that it's on Lecter.
Because
Hannibal is not... being douchey in this scene. He's supposed to be cool and awesome and rad. And
I think that's actually part of the dinner conversation. You know, they're like, man, Hannibal's rad.
Yeah.
Hannibal's pretty rad.
Exactly. Totally.
Thanks for killing the flutist.
Right.
Flautist.
The flautist. Because it was so offensive.
So we're going to wrap it up here.
Ah.
Next week in... podcast time. Silence of the Lambs.
Yes.
And I have a feeling we're going to be more positive.
Yes.
I have a feeling.
Just an inkling.
Honestly, I have one complaint with Silence of the Lambs. That's it.
Really?
One. And we'll talk about that next week.
All right. Yeah.
I don't want to spend my entire complaint.
Okay.
All the cons. All one con.
The long con.
Yes.
Yeah.
On this episode. And there will probably be some James Gunn voice.
Oh, boy.
I mean, I may do the whole podcast in that voice.
Oh,
so uncomfortable.
That's very uncomfortable.
It is. It's really uncomfortable. But I guess if you have to.
I guess if there were ever a time where it fit.
it would be appropriate.
Because he does it a lot without it being appropriate.
I do.
Oh,
it's,
I know.
It's a thing.
It should be your answering message on your phone.
I actually made that comment.
Would you leave a message?
Yeah.
Where did
that come up?
That was on Twitter, I think.
It was something
I'd leave a good message.
Yeah, you were doing it, and I was like, you should do that. It's like somebody's outgoing voicemail message.
So I just gave it to you. All you have to do is take this podcast
right
there.
Up there.
Would you leave a message?
Oh, dear.
Right, exactly.
I'd fuck me.
Well, has to be somebody's ringtone.
And I hope you enjoyed last week's episode that we're recording next week about Manhunter.
Which I think was probably also a bit more upbeat and
I don't
positive.
Know. I bet I have a lot of complaints.
Oh, I'm sure you do. But I think it's going to be more balanced.
Probably. I have a feeling... I have a feeling Sean Coletti, who was our guest last week, is going to ground us a little bit more. This is weird time.
I know. It's hard to talk about something that hasn't happened.
That hasn't happened yet. But we'll leave it with Miko. Where can they find you online?
You can find me at Technogeisha on Twitter, Miko Technogeisha on Facebook. You can also find me at that same name at Google Plus if you still do that
nobody
sort of
that.
Thing. I know. I was like,
Google has disbanded.
I realized I stopped Google saying Plus. It, and I was like, I don't even think anybody does that anymore.
We have some Google Groups.
Mm-hmm. Well, Google Groups is different.
Yeah, that's
well,
different.
It's than, G Plus.
Okay. Yeah, like Hangouts really cool, but G Plus is kind of I don't know. It fizzled. Miko. Now I threw myself off.
Well, you threw Google Plus in there. I don't know what that was about. Technogeisha.com. You can probably find you.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Technogeisha.com, and I'm also on Life at the Swing. So.
And Ophelia, how about you? Are you on Google Plus?
I am on Google Plus.
I too am on Google Plus.
And they can find me at Ophelia Tesla on Twitter, Ophelia Tesla on Facebook. And at OpheliaTesla at gmail.com.
And you can find me at CooperSBeckett.com. Don't go to my Google Plus page. Really, there's nothing.
There's nothing of value there.
Yeah. It's not worth going to.
At Cooper S. Beckett on Twitter and Cooper Beckett on Facebook. You can find us as a podcast at Eat the Rootcast, eattherootcast.com, and info@eattherootcast.com. I'm curious what our fact checkers are going to do with these episodes. I don't know if there will be the passion.
Yeah, that's true.
There might be some.
I can't wait to read the comments for this. I hope there are some.
I hope so too. Please leave us comments with your thoughts.
Yeah. It might be all okay. Here's some positive things to say after.
By the way, so you negative. Guys forgot.
Yes. Or you got this wrong, or this is really how this is. Because as much as I try to research and remember, I don't have time between the time I see it to actually go back and look at every single detail. So a lot of this is we're just based on memory of like a book we read a year ago.
Yes.
That we do try to go back in, but there's just not enough time between viewing and doing the podcast to fact check everything. So thank you to all of you that take the time.
Yes.
You know, because I love to read that stuff.
You are our fact checker.
I do love to read that stuff. Oh, and don't forget our Tumblr.
Eattherootcast.tumblr.com. I forget because I don't use Tumblr, and it still confuses me.
All these kids out the tumbling in their Tumblr.
We also need to mention that the Twin Peaks podcast will be back probably around the beginning of 2016, and it's an amazing week because Twin Peaks is filming.
Yes.
There's actually David Lynch directing scenes from Twin Peaks right now. It's amazing. I never thought that would happen again.
Oh, and looking at the photos, I just want to be there.
Yeah. Well, it without question, we now have to go to the R&R Diner in Snoqualmie and
get ourselves a damn good cup of coffee.
Yeah.
And some,
I am just amazed that it's happening.
It's actually happening.
Even if he quits now, there is something from Twin Peaks. That's the thing.
Just get something in the can before
anything.
You give it up.
Just Shelley serving a cup of coffee and then put it online and I'm happy. That's
just
all
Shelley?
I need. Just Shelley.
I want Cooper. I want Dale Cooper. I don't need Shelley.
Oh, come on. Everybody needs Shelley. We also want Dale Cooper, but everybody needs Shelley. Let's wrap it up because that's a whole different podcast.
Yes.
Whole different podcast.
Oh, and then Ashcast is...
And the Ashcast is coming.
It's coming. We've got a lot coming.
Coming soon.
We do. So thanks for joining us at the table.
Hey, this is Dan Savage from the Savage Lovecast and Savage Love, and you're listening to a Swing Set podcast at Swing Set FM.